of the Romantic Violence Memoir of an American Skinhead, Christian Picciolini, National Geographic Explorer and Cave Diver Kenny Broad, and live music in Studio 435 from Material Reissue. And now, here's your host, a man who refuses to take off his winter coat, Justin Kaufman.
I'm taking a firm approach to this heat wave. Act like you've been here before, right? If you're a Chicagoan, you got to keep it like, you got to keep it real. And real for me is my scarf, my hat, my gloves, and my winter coat. You know, you want to be hard. You want to be sort of, you know, you want people to know that you're from here. I know it's February. What a tremendous, tremendous weekend. We all loved it. But I also know in the back of my head, hey, it's February. I'm not changing my clothes. We talked about this a little bit. I'm not going into the closet and getting the spring stuff out. I saw people walking around with shorts and obvious, like, pastel, like, summer clothing. No.
No way. It's way too early for men in flip-flops.
Right. Way too many flip-flops. I saw flip. I saw flop. I saw them together. I saw them apart. Too much. That's what I'm saying. I stayed to my roots. I had my winter hat on the whole time. My son at one point said, "Dad, what's with the hat?" I'm like, "It's February." I am honoring the weather. I understand how the weather works. In 2 seconds, it could be cold. So, tonight I'm wearing my long johns, my wool sweater, and my knit cap. Sounds good. It's Justin Kaufman here. It's a download on 720 WGN. We got a great show lined up tonight. Wow. I can't tell you, man. This is one of those shows where it's just amazing when you get to work on Monday. You're like, I can't believe we put this much together for one night. Tonight, in studio, my guest at the big table, the author of Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead, Christian Picciolini, will be in studio. We will talk about his time in the late 80s, early 90s as the leader of the white supremacist movement here in Chicago, down in Blue Island, and how he got out of it. He set up a not-for-profit sort of peace group called Life After Hate. He now tries to recruit people who are involved in that movement to get out. So we'll talk with Christian, who will be in studio at 8 o'clock. Coming up at 9 o'clock tonight, what? I mean, come on. Kenny Broad, National Geographic Explorer of the Year, as well as a cave diver. He's going to talk about his life as an explorer on the frontier, the final frontier, underwater caves. He's going to be at the Goodman tomorrow for a big show, an event. Also, tonight we've got live music in studio with Material Reissue. It's hard to believe it's been just over 20 years since Jim Ellison, the lead singer of Material Issue, took his own life. Material Reissue, the members of the band are together and they are performing the hits of Material Issue as well as other music, and they will be in Studio 435 tonight. International Pop Overthrow. I want to ask what the status is on that overthrow. Where are we at with the International Pop Overthrow, Material Issue? Oh, good. Just wanted to get a status check for all the investors bought into that. And where's Valerie? That's the other question. Also tonight, Sudanese-American singer-songwriter Sing Kane will join us. He's got a big show at Lincoln Hall coming up on Thursday. Sing Kane is a tremendous, tremendous musician. World music, a lot of Afro beats, percussions. He not only has got a great new record that is out now, but he has just come off of performing in a super group with David Byrne from Talking Heads, others. I mean, people from LCD Sound System. So many bands that come together to create this super group that Sing Kane was the music director, the band leader for. We'll talk with Sing Kane coming up as well in the 9 o'clock hour. And Chris Veronis is in for Chris Roebling. Dave Lundy is back. We will have Touche coming up after the 7:30 news, but they have to do it in Swedish accents. Sound good? News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier, and I believe Esmeralda is back tonight. Maybe, maybe not. We'll see. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download. a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We've got a jam-packed show. I'm so excited to be with you on this beautiful night in Chicago, in the Chicago area. Again, 312-981-7200 for anyone who's listening any further away than Fort Collins, Colorado, on the radio. You can't do the app stuff. Last time we were on, I think it was Thursday, we got a buddy of mine sent a car radio video that just showed his car radio, and it was 720. And you could hear my voice on the radio. And Fort Collins, Colorado, was such a beautiful night, clear night, that they were getting that signal all the way to Fort Collins, Colorado, 1,000 miles away. So keep them coming. Pete's giving away pizzas. If you can beat 1,000 miles, which nobody really could, that's the problem. We got some that were questionable. You know, I can get, it's easy to say it, but tell us where you're listening. 312-981-7200. If it's in Chicago, no one cares. I'm just joking, of course. All right, it's time for the carryout here on the download. This, of course, our nightly news segment where I do read the news. So you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. It's President's Day, and what better way to learn more about the presidents than to take to the streets for the Not My President's Day protest. Chicago's was in front of the Trump Tower, which is ingenious because he's the president. Wow. The protests were in response to the first couple weeks of the Trump presidency, and from what I could tell, everybody kept their pants on. So good to know there were no mass moonings today. But hey, the night is still young. President Trump continues to double down on his strange comments over the weekend about Sweden. Apparently, Trump watched a TV report from Fox about surging refugees in Sweden and how some are worried about security. In his head, he went, oh, you know what? Yeah, I should talk about that. But you know, it's just too boring. What if I made it seem like I was referring to a vague attack? No, you know what? It's too benign. You know what? I'll just act like an attack happened. No one will notice. We good? Should I go with a tie or no tie? No tie? Really? People love the long tie? Okay, no tie. Good. And then when questioned, Trump just said that it's the media and the Swedish police, they're covering up the crimes. Then he quoted Wayne's World by saying, not, after saying that things were great in Sweden. He actually did that on Twitter. Things are great in Sweden. Not. What are you doing? I believe the first president to use the not joke 20 plus years after it was actually in vogue. Grandpa, nobody uses the joke anymore. It's 5 p.m. Wheel of Fortune's on. Take your pill. Go to bed. You're a tremendous, inspiring leader. Not. Who does the not joke? Come on, man. Today, Trump continued to say that the media was the enemy of the people, saying he's not even the first president to say that. Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, Andrew Jackson, they hated the media. Although Trump is the first to say that the media was the enemy of the people. But to be fair, I've been saying this ever since ESPN put their NFL mock drafts behind a paywall. So you can understand. Breitbart editor and comedian Milo Yiannopoulos lost his book deal and an invite to the CPAC, which, what's CPAC? It's, think conservative Lollapalooza. A hit piece video surfaces on Milo talking about pedophilia, but not really. The most alarming thing is that it was put out by a Republican source. I saw Milo on Bill Maher this weekend, and it struck me that this dude is just a low-rent gay conservative version of Sarah Silverman. Really is. He's gross. He's politically incorrect. He's smug. So I guess he's just going to run for president in 2024. I saw the piece. I was like, I was very excited because I don't know a lot about this guy, and he's causing so much turmoil and chaos. And I watched him, and I was like, this guy? He's just he's a comedian who doesn't know when to stop. And that's his shtick. That's it? Come on. We saw it with Andrew Dice Clay. He's like the two live crew of conservative politics. Chicago City Council is going to vote on a new ordinance to crack down on street performers. Yep. I guess it's that time of the decade where politicians run out of things to get involved in. So the new ordinance is essentially that you can't play buckets like a drum. That's essentially the ordinance that's going to be voted on Wednesday. The TSA at JFK Airport in New York are in hot water for allegedly leaving security checkpoints wide open and letting passengers skip security altogether. It's unclear why the security lanes were left open, but when you gotta go, you gots to go, right? They need to do it how we do it on Halloween. Just put the candy out with a sign. Take one. In this case, if you're a terrorist, screen yourself. Be honest. Come on. NASA is holding a press conference on Wednesday to make a major announcement about a new discovery, perhaps a new planet. My guess, it's an hour and 20 free-for-all where they just call the Jewish reporter a liar and tell him to sit down. No, that's how normal press conferences go in this day, right? Yeah. Anyway, I hope this new planet has Wi-Fi. In weather, what an amazing, dangerous time to be alive. If there was a way for Trump to regulate a nice three-day weekend in February every day without it being some harbinger of death for the planet, I am game. Who needs to go to Florida when we have this? Also flooding in California. You know, that could easily be us, right? That Chicago's built on a floodplain and it's only a matter of time till that happens here. All right, as long as we're on the same page. Also, it's going to suck when it gets to 120 this summer. So enjoy. Stuff's going to be gone by Thursday. In sports, I didn't watch the All-Star game last night, but I saw that former Chicago high school product Anthony Davis poured in 52 points. I also kept seeing the hashtag Win Butler, so I assumed Jimmy Butler had a huge game and they wanted him to be the MVP, but then I realized it was for Win Butler, the lead singer of Arcade Fire, who played in the celebrity game. My bad. Anyway, trade deadline for the NBA is this Friday, and all of the players for the Bulls should be out in the front yard of the United Center like an old-fashioned yard sale. How much for this old Dwayne Wade? I'll give you 10 bucks. In better basketball news, the Northwestern Wildcats welcome Scotty Lindsey back to the hardwood and beat up on Rutgers to win their 20th game Saturday. They currently sit in fourth place in the Big Ten, only two games back from the top seed. This could get them the bye in the Big Ten tournament, but right now it's looking like the Cats are going to go mad this March. Whew, which is good news because it's been like 3 years straight without a team from Illinois in the tourney. Outside chance that the Illinois State Redbirds could also make a run, but they got to beat Wichita State in their conference championship to get in, and that's a tough one. The Blackhawks are back in the winning column, beating up on poor Buffalo. The win made the Sun-Times suggest that maybe the Hawks don't need to make a move at the upcoming trade deadline because sleepy players are starting to step up. What? So no Versteeg? We're not going to get Versteeg again? So he can rap at the rally? It's the best part of the Blackhawks rally, when Versteeg raps. Ah, darn it. Cubs and Sox are now fully operational in Arizona. All eyes on the Cubs, but our eyes in the back of our heads? On the White Sox. A lot of great young talent in that camp. There's some feelings swirling around in my stomach about this team. I'm not sure what it is. I can feel it, though. I like it. Dexter Fowler tweeted something about Trump, and Cardinal fans are all mad at him. You ain't in a blue state anymore, Dexter. Gotta watch the old 140 characters there, buddy. And finally tonight, a new study says that the most congested traffic in the world belongs to Los Angeles. Congrats. Runner-up, close second, the line on a Saturday afternoon at Joann Fabrics. Come on. Open up another lane. I can barely hold all this yarn. That's the carryout for June 20th, 2017. Oh, wait. Did I say June? It's February. How many times did you make that mistake this weekend? All right, coming up, Dave Lundy and Chris Veronis are going to argue about politics. What are we going to talk about? Sweden, Russia, the media. So much to talk about over and over and over. It's a download coming up, 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right, 612 says, listening from Plymouth, Minnesota. I tune in for Roe, but sometimes I stick around for you. Thanks.
Hey there, Minnesota.
There you go. Rob Martier, how are you, man? How was your weekend?
Doing well. It was great. We took the kids to see Monster Trucks at Allstate Arena.
Yeah, wow. How was that? Is it loud? I mean, is it, obviously it's loud, but I mean, is it like ear-piercingly loud?
It's wonderfully loud. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's that deep kind of guttural sort of, you know, lots of horsepower under there.
Do they do, is it just Monster Trucks jumping around, or do they do some demolition type stuff?
They've got a whole kind of complement of different things going on. They've got the little ATVs, they've got the kind of the sport class thing, and then the trucks do this thing called the, it's like where they come out and they freestyle, is what they call it.
Oh, nice.
These guys are so good. What they do is they get the front wheels up, then they gun the engine, and then they get up on top of the kind of the jump thing.
Yeah.
And if they can feather the throttle just enough, they can keep the truck vertical, like on its hind legs,
like
on its back
over
wheels.
Over the jump. Wow.
It's so cool.
That's awesome.
I loved it.
All right.
Every minute.
Yeah. Mm. I saw a bunch of stuff on it on Instagram this weekend. I was like, oh, man, how did I miss that?
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right? Touché.
You go right, you go left, you go left, you go
That's right. It's time for Touché here on The Download, our weekly look at national politics with Dave Lundy and Chris Roebling. Chris Roebling still out of the country, so Chris Veronis is in. You know, hey, this is how I forgot the player. Who's the Yankee player who didn't show up, and then the other Yankee player? Oh, forget it.
Boy, it's you Chicago. Delivered on that one. <It's>,
we don't. You know that
Yankees.
Old song.
Yeah,
I'm sure
course.
That one yeah. New York Yankee it's, who I think there was another New York. Anyways, Babe Ruth. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm sure Roebling. I'm sure Roebling's listening. Yeah, right. You know, right
they
now,
all look
going
good in
like
stripes.
They all do. Dave Lundy, Chris Veronis. Good to see you guys. All right, so let's get to it tonight. Why don't we? I mean, I guess we start with the protests here in Chicago and around the country. Not my President's Day. Why don't we start there? This is starting to become a regular thing. We've seen 5 days straight of protests in New York City about Donald Trump. Essentially everything about Donald Trump. Today, a big showing, but not like we saw on the Women's Day that was back in January. What do you think of the protests today, and what are they saying about Donald Trump and the country?
You know, I have to support the protests today because my son was featured on television in one of them and was interviewed for them. So I naturally support the protests. That said, I think that the protests... I think they're effective. I think that what they're doing with the town hall meetings is freaking the heck out of the Republicans. They're like, well, what do you mean? I thought we only got to do this with Tea Partiers to Democrats. You're doing it to us. We don't understand. So I think it's great. But I think you need to have a message. And I think you need to have a clear message and you need to have a focus. And so, hey, I have participated in protests over the Muslim ban. I participated in protests out at O'Hare. But, you know, at a certain point, you have to really focus it out. And I think now is that time.
Chris, go ahead.
Well, I support the First Amendment right to speech and assembly, even though the hard left would deny that at places like Berkeley.
But of course, one incident.
Of course, that's another story.
Roebling would be proud.
No problem if they want to get together. You talked about message, and I think that is important. You can't have a legitimate opposition movement that condemns people who say, you don't believe Barack Obama is our president, and then does the same for Trump. I mean, there's a little inconsistency here. And so again, I know it hurts. I know it stings. I know it's unfair. But if there's anything that's going to – if you want a viable political movement, you have to step up and lead by example. That's it.
Yeah. I
have to say – notwithstanding the fact that my son and wife and other right. son, Max, also protested, just wasn't on television because he's six. Look, I'm actually not a fan of the concept of not my president. He is my president. He's your president. He's our president.
Thank you, Dave.
He's all our presidents. And I've said that consistently.
And you could still oppose him.
Yes, it does sting. And yes, I have trouble saying the words president,
right.
You know, that one. But he's our president. So mm-hmm. I think that was my nice way of saying we really need to be focused on a key
message.
Well,
it sounds to me, and you know, I'll stick up for the protesters. I wasn't out there. I have no family members that were out there today. But I will say that, you know, the one, I think that they're just theming them. They'll have one coming up on tax day that's about tax returns. Today was a play on the president's. I don't know if it's necessarily trying to delegitimize this president. I think they're saying that this is not how we want our country to go, especially when it comes to what we've seen in the first month of President Trump.
Well, certainly Donald Trump is going to interpret it that way, that the slightest bit of criticism delegitimizes him, and he's going to erupt. I mean, we know that. But at the same time, if you talk to the average liberal, Democrat, anti-Trumper, they reject him outright. Under the basis that bullies, mean people should not get elected, should not be president, which is a fair point of view. But I'm just saying, Dave, and I think you could agree with this, the average anti-Trumper outright rejects him.
Well,
there's no room for compromise.
I mean, look, I outright reject him because pretty much I disagree with 98% of what he's done so far.
And yet,
with
you say
one exception,
he's still your president.
Well, he is.
Yeah.
Here's the concept that General Flynn didn't understand, and neither does Donald Trump. We have one president at a time. At this time, it's Donald Trump. We are By the way, today, happy 148th day. We're 148th through Donald Trump's term. But look, I can reject him, but still say he's my president. I mean, he just is. So, but look, I fully support the protest. And I think that we should keep protesting specific things. I think we should protest actions. We should protest his attacks on Sweden. No, I'm kidding. I mean, frankly, one thing, it's not a protest issue, but one thing I found extremely disturbing out of the press conference last week, and I realize that's a big area to choose mm-hmm. from, but was the way he treated the Jewish reporter who was asking a right. question about rising anti-Semitism. Today alone, there were 11 bomb threats called into JCC, Jewish community centers around the country. There have been more than 60 since he was inaugurated. There were anti-Semitic acts at the Chicago Loop Synagogue, at the Illinois Holocaust Museum. It's happening all around the country in ways I, as a Jew, have never seen in my life. And it's terrifying. And yeah. Donald Trump and obviously misunderstood the question.
Do you pin that on Donald Trump? That's the question. Is it a rising tide that if Barack Obama was still president, you say it would be Donald Trump?
No, look, Donald Trump and that entire campaign gave license to what is happening now. It encouraged it. It promoted it. It fomented it. And bringing Steve Bannon, the guy who gave the platform to the white supremacists and the anti-Semites and the neo-Nazis, into the White House and giving him the top security position is exactly the kind of thing that has encouraged. That's why David Duke keeps talking about how awesome Donald Trump is.
Breitbart himself, before he died, was Jewish. The editor of Breitbart is Jewish. The senior editor of Breitbart is Jewish. You cannot draw a dotted line between anti-Semitism, these attacks that you're talking about in the JCCs, and Donald Trump. But Donald Trump should use his moral authority to the extent that he understands right. it or knows
you'd
how
like
to use
see,
it.
You'd like to see him at least come it, out, it, or at least it, in the situation it, with the press conference.
It's fair and it's appropriate right. for Donald Trump to say any violence targeted at any group of people is wrong.
Well, I agree. Yeah. I agree with you, actually, that you can't draw a dotted line. I can draw a straight line with a thick marker. This is not an accident.
Good soundbite.
This is direct.
I think that was spontaneous.
He's been waiting for it. He's been holding on it for a while.
It was very good.
In studio with me, Dave Lundy, Chris Varonis. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We got much more to talk about. I'd love to talk about Sweden, what happened this weekend in Florida. Also, I'm interested in how you guys perceive. We haven't really talked about the ratcheting up of the enemy of the people, the media. We've seen this over the weekend, but between the time we talked last week, Chris, you know, it's even gotten more. So we'll talk a little bit about even today as he doubled down on the idea that other presidents hated the media as well. It just seems to be we'll sort of dissect what he's talking about and if he's got a point. Dave Lundy, Chris Varonis, my guests. Touché. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touché.
Touché. Chris Varonis, Dave Lundy in studio tonight. We're talking about national politics. It's the week that was pretty tame day yesterday when it came to, you know, Face the Nation and other interviews like that. Rance Priebus. Was a Reince. Mr. Priebus talked a little bit about, you know, we should stop giggling or not taking what Donald Trump says seriously. He is serious about the press. The press is the enemy. They need to be put in check. Okay, let's talk about this because this was all on Friday night. I believe Friday night is when we got the tweet that the failing New York Times and all of the news are the enemy of the people. What's the takeaway on this? Because I read an article this weekend, I think it was Salon or Slater, one of them saying, this is the first time a Western leader in any form has ever uttered the words enemy of the people. So, I mean, there is some precedent involved in what is happening.
For me, as a Republican and a conservative, this is a bridge too far. I think Trump eschews a media that is decidedly liberal, that's got an axe to grind for him. He eschews that with just outright opposition to America and the American idea. Trump's never one to make a modest proposal or just a moderate attack. I mean, he's got to take it to 11.
Right.
We know that. That's his style. And yet we've got three co-equal branches of government. I think this is just a conversation that Trump's inner monologue is having with the rest of the country. That's what it is. I guess I don't like it. I think he should moderate this kind of language. At the end of the day, I just see this as red meat for his base.
Yeah, it is red meat for his base. But when it's one thing when you're candidate Trump, it's another thing when you're the president of the United States. And I'm not saying the president can't attack the media. Of course he can. Presidents always have. But even Richard Nixon, who said the press was an enemy, he said it privately to one of his aides. It was recorded on a tape, and it was an enemy of the administration. It wasn't an enemy of the people. The First Amendment is the First Amendment for a reason. And tons of Republicans over the weekend were just like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
Does it hurt him when he says this? Are we going to get to a point where there will be one or two tweets where you're like, oh, that hurt him?
Trump right now is on the shot clock, and he knows it. And he's going to be judged by his policy achievements. The clock's ticking right now, and the base is watching, and they're willing to give him a pass on almost everything. So that's one thing. That's sort of the big overhang that's above Trump right now. The other is, I think this kind of rhetorical line's wearing thin. I think people are going to get fed up with it. If we run into a correction, a downturn, if there's some failures, it's going to wear thin. And then when Trump takes that inevitable fall, then we'll see who he is.
Yeah, and the concern, though, on this media issue is that there are a lot of crazy people out there with guns. There are crazy people without guns, but there are a lot of crazy people in America with guns. And, you know, reporters don't have protection. They don't have the Secret Service around them. You know, all it's going to take is one crazy guy or one crazy woman with a gun attacking a reporter and killing a reporter. I mean, look, reporters die every year in around the world trying to do their jobs. Certainly if you're Russian, a lot of them die through polonium poisoning by Donald Trump's best friend, Vladimir Putin. But look, I think this can become very serious. Yeah. I agree with you. He will be judged based on his accomplishments. It is only 1/48th through his term. God willing, his only term. But, you know, look, he's already reneged on a bunch of things. We'll see if he can deliver.
He's achieved a lot of things, too.
Let me ask you about Sweden. Without the joke of nothing happened last night. And he seemed to make a mistake by saying last night. That seems to be what's tripped him up here. But his point being that the media is not reporting on these stories. The Swedish police, liberal police forces, is not reporting and is doing what they can to cover it up to make it seem like Sweden is having a good experience with Muslim refugees or refugees from Syria. I mean, is there any sort of logic to be pulled from the idea of mentioning Sweden in this context?
There is logic, and here's what it is. The logic is that Donald Trump does not listen to his intelligence advisors. He watches Fox News, and I'm not trying to be facetious. That is actually what happened. He watched a Fox News report the night before on television. It was a Fox News report. It was a Fox News report based upon, and this is information provided by our friend Kitty Kurth. It was based upon one crazy guy created a video. He interviewed Swedish police, but he mixed and matched the questions and the answers.
So
they all have rejected it.
Sort of like one of these.
They've all said
pieces.
It hasn't happened.
Yeah.
And the crime rate in Sweden hasn't actually gone up.
Here's my question. My question about Donald Trump and Sweden and the media is for a guy who rails against fake news and calls out the media at every turn for being fake, that uses the same media he talks about to be his rallying cry to help him,
prop him up.
I mean, you can find the contradictions in there. Are the American people, and I hate to use that phrase because now it's a Donald Trump phrase, but are people getting savvy to that where they're like, how could you on one hand call everybody fake and on the next hand be like, I saw this story, I want to tell you all about it.
I don't know if they're getting savvy to it so much as they are, what the hell are we talking about? You know, as a wise man once said, Obi-Wan Kenobi, who's the fool? The fool or the fool that follows? I mean, for Donald Trump, let's face it, in his style of ranting word salad, incomprehensible speech, forms his opinion on the last guy he talks to, many people say. For him to make some off-the-cuff comment that has no basis at a rally And all of a sudden, CNN's running 24-hour coverage of what he said.
Well, Dave, respond on that.
It's ridiculous.
Should it just be overlooked? Is it just we should now know he has mouth diarrhea? Is that the...
Okay, but...
it's not to let Trump off the hook either.
No, okay? I hear you. But we were told that we took Donald Trump's words too seriously during the campaign, that he wasn't really going to do all these things that he said he was going to do. He wasn't really going to launch a Muslim ban. He wasn't really going to build the wall. He wasn't going to do all these things. Well, guess what?
Well, he said something stupid.
No. I mean,
that's it.
He's doing everything he said. I will give the Donald Trump people that. He's absolutely trying to do the things that he claimed he was going to do. So how are we supposed to know which Trumpisms we're supposed to take seriously and literally, and which ones were not?
Well,
I think that when a guy gets up to the podium and says the leaks are real but the news is fake, I'm like, there's a logical inconsistency.
Dave, God bless you. Good points. I agree. I just have to say the media catastrophizing is just ridiculous.
Okay, so let me bring this
back. Out there. It's real.
There seems to be some thought, and Bill Maher has talked about it this week and others, that this is all diversionary, that Sweden and everything that he does is he's a little bit more manipulator-in-chief. He's not as dumb as we think he is. And this is a diversionary tactic to what's happening with Russia. And as the panel and Bill Maher said, the worst presidential scandal of all time. The idea that perhaps a foreign entity helped elect a person to the office of president. Is that true? I mean, is there some truth in the fact that this is a bigger scandal than sort of the Trump administration wants you to believe?
Well, yes, clearly, because they keep saying Russia. He said again at that press conference, Russia is fake news. No, Russia is not fake news. The subpoenas that are going to go out are not fake. The FBI investigations are not fake. Something seriously happened here, and we have to get to the bottom of it. We know Flynn lied. We are going to get to the bottom of it.
It's happening.
My view of this, though, is that, yes, some of these things are distractions, but what's to be distracted from? The investigators have to do their investigating. It's going to take some time. The news media is going to come out every day with stories, and that will happen over time. So I can actually walk and chew gum at the same time. I can pay attention to the dysfunction of a White House that lost a series of national security advisors until they finally hit on the good guy. They actually apparently have hit on a guy who, by all press reports, this is going to be really interesting. I give him 6 months, because the one thing he's reported, General McMaster's, is reported to say is he does not tolerate big egos well, and he calls them out.
Well, you wrote a book condemning political big egos.
Right. This should be interesting.
Yeah, it should be. It should be. Well, so at moments like this, and I do think the Russian thing is real and it's not a ruse, I thank my lucky stars for the dead white men who founded this country. Co-equal branches. What you're seeing congressional Republicans leading this investigation that's already started. Mm-hmm. You're also seeing congressional Republicans putting some space between them and Trump. You know, you've got John Cronin in Texas. You've got Paul Ryan, who are going to do a border tour. And they're going to come out with their own insights, their own conclusions on what's happening across the border. So I'm just saying, Davey, I mean, you can go after Trump all you want. He's one of three branches of government.
Yes. And with all due respect, I will believe the investigations will be real when we see their output. In the meantime, I know what people like Rand Paul are saying, which is that investigations are not productive exercises, especially when you're investigating your own party. Thank you for having a Washington gaffe. You admit that really you just don't want to investigate Republicans.
You also have John McCain out there. You also have
John McCain voted with the president 94% of the time, Lindsey Graham 100% of the time.
These are fake critics.
They haven't actually done anything real. And I will believe it when I see it.
Fake commentary.
Everyone's talking fake news.
Touché.
I like fake critics. Fake commentary and fake critics. Dave Lundy and Chris Varonis, my guests tonight. Touché every Monday night here on The Download. Gentlemen, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Kenny Broad's going to join us. He is the National Geographic Explorer of the Year. He's also going to be on stage at the Goodman Theater talking about The Passion versus the Risk, a new series of that National Geographic does, National Geographic Live all over the country. It's like a tour, and they're going to be at the Goodman Theater tonight and tomorrow. But we'll talk with Kenny tonight about his life, exploring everything from venomous snakes in Vietnam to the underwater caves in the Bahamas, the Blue Holes. It's a life. It's a life. Also coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, musician, Sudanese American musician Sinkane, great new album that's out, solo record that's getting a lot of buzz. He's doing tremendous work. He just got off of working with David Byrne and members from LCD Sound System, Blur, and other bands in a super group. We'll talk to him about that. He's going to be at Lincoln Hall coming up on Thursday. And in the 10 o'clock hour tonight, very excited to have live in Studio 435 Material Reissue. The band, of course, Material Issue, is back together playing the hits, and we will talk to them and hear some music. I can't wait. International Pop Overthrow. It's been 20 years since that record. Wow. Well, my guest tonight at the big table was once the leader of the white supremacist movement here in the Chicago area. Kristen Piccolini grew up in Blue Island, and for a short stint in Oak Forest. Blue Island's a working-class neighborhood on the southwest side of Chicago. He was a self-described loner who had a hard time fitting in until he found a purpose. Piccolini rose to power as the leader of the neo-Nazi skinheads in the late 80s, early 90s, mainly through white power punk music, which he played in bands like Way and Final Solution. But as he grew older, into his 20s, Piccolini used family and a record store to escape the violent world that he in part created. He rehabilitated in 2010, and he co-founded the not-for-profit Life After Hate. And last year, he wrote the book Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead, and he joins me at the big table tonight. Christian, thanks for being here.
Justin, it's my pleasure.
So let's talk about your life. I mean, you grew up, I mean, you start your life and your roots are in Blue Island.
Yeah, I've was there my whole life, even though for part of my life I actually didn't live there.
Yeah,
I grew up there because my grandparents in part raised me.
What was Blue Island like? Talk about it in the 70s, 80s.
Oh, wow. It was a really great place to live and grow up. You know, back in the days when your parents would let you out on the street till midnight when you were 12 years old and, you know, you came in when the street lights went off. A large portion of Italians from my mother's village in Italy moved to that area. They even set up a church in the patron saint's name. It was just a really cool place, very working class place to live.
And you talked about sort of going back and forth and stints because you spent some time in Oak Forest. But what that did in reading your memoir was just give you a little bit of a loner. Didn't have friends in Blue Island. You didn't have friends in Oak Forest because you were split in time.
Yeah. You know, my parents were Italian immigrants who moved to the U.S. in the mid 60s and, you know, they had a hard time fitting in. They fit in very well into this Italian neighborhood of Blue Island. But then they decided when I was born to move to Oak Forest because they wanted kind of a more upscale place to raise me. But what that did for me was create a huge problem because the Italian kids then thought I was a sellout and I was too American for them. And the American kids saw me as kind of this really weird Italian kid.
A minority, really.
Yeah, I was the minority. Yeah. I ate Nutella sandwiches and my parents spoke a different language and we had these weird customs. So I never really fit in and I got bullied quite a bit growing up.
You know, when you talk about, I mean, there, you know, when you got back to Blue Island and you talk about trying to sort of assimilate and get in with the High Street Boys and, yeah. And the, you know, he talked about in the book, there really was this sort of like this moment where you were trying to, at all costs, to fit in, to find a community because it just wasn't afforded to you.
Yeah, you know, and I think that that's really no different than what every young person goes through. It's that struggle for identity, that struggle for community and, you know, having this sense of purpose that you have absolutely no idea how to focus. So I was trying to fit in. I really wanted to be somebody, even as a shy, introverted kid who was, you know, shorter than everybody else. I just wanted to be one of the guys.
And one of the guys, you know, in Blue Island was, like you said, I mean, it was an Italian-American neighborhood, and yeah. It wanted to stay that way. There's about, you know, it's the southwest side of Chicago, but it's still a Chicago neighborhood, and it's boundaries with some South Side neighborhoods, African-American neighborhoods, Beverly, other places.
Sure.
Talk about the idea of sort of being territorial, the boundary of Blue Island.
Well, the area that I lived in was the Italian portion. It was on the east side, which was kind of the lower middle class side. And there was a huge population of Italian people that all knew each other back from the old country. So I didn't really hear the racism. I didn't see the racism, but there was kind of this inherent, you know, not my neighborhood kind of thing, mm-hmm. Where, you know, I didn't hear anybody outwardly speaking, you know, slur words or anything like that. But there was this feeling that, you know, this was the Italian neighborhood and they didn't really want anybody else coming into that area.
And how did, I mean, as kids, I mean, that sort of became, you know, part, I mean, you kind of talk about it in the book, and it's no different than I think a lot of Chicago neighborhoods or even suburbs where you sort of, you know, you kept people that weren't part of that circle out.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that that's a fear factor, right? We're scared of what we don't know. And especially people coming from kind of a different country and not even being accustomed to the customs of this country, to have people that they absolutely have nothing in common with, or so they think. It was a fear thing. They were scared of what they didn't understand. And I think most people from very strong ethnic communities may feel that same way.
There's definitely, I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, you think about the way that Chicago is even sort of categorized, or always in a very sort of positive way, a melting pot, city of neighborhoods.
Yeah.
But there are neighborhood boundaries. And we saw this in Chicago in so many ways. We've seen it when, you know, a lot of violence in Bridgeport, you know, and other places like that. You know, for you, when was it the first, I mean, because that it seems to be somewhat of a normal protect your hood.
Mm-hmm.
But when did the sentiment that it was more about, you know, sort of the idea of white supremacy or the idea of racism, when did it start to creep in?
You know, I fell in with America's first neo-Nazi skinhead group, not because of the racism, because I wasn't raised that way. My parents weren't racist. They were often the victims of prejudice when they came to the U.S. I fell in because I was seeking that community. I was looking for that identity. I wanted power when I felt the most powerless. And, you know, being an ambitious young person, they focused my sense of, you know, doing something important into something very bad. So the ideology came a little bit later. It was really just about
it was youth
belonging.
Culture. It was belonging, but it was also punk music. There was a little bit like the sort of things.
It was a subculture.
It was a subculture.
Yeah,
right.
And I was 14 years old, and I was looking for something, and this guy who I met walked across my path and convinced me that there was a better way, and that I wouldn't feel powerless, that I wouldn't be marginalized, that I would be powerful and respected. And I said, "Yeah, okay, I'll do that. What do you want me to do?"
Well, let's take a quick break, and we'll get into the story of Clark Martell and the other sort of neo-Nazi skinheads that you fell into and that ultimately became the leader of. Christian Piccolini is in studio with me. He is a reformed American neo-Nazi skinhead. The memoir is Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead. He's going to be speaking in Skokie at the Ethical Humanist Society on March 5th. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back more with Christian. Stay with us. My guest tonight here at the big table, Christian Piccolini. He is the author of Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead. He is going to be speaking in Skokie at the, Ethical Humanist Society. That's on March 5th. Really, this is a story of reform, rehabilitation, of being a neo-Nazi skinhead.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked right before the break about sort of the idea of being a 14-year-old kid. And the thing, Christian, about this book, which is crazy, is it's 300 pages of life before you were 20.
Yeah.
I mean, to talk about where you began at 14 years old, talking to a neighbor who lived across the street, to where it ended when you're 20, 21 years old, it's an amazing read for 6 years of a very turbulent lifestyle and life. Yeah. Christian, Clark Martell comes over. He gets out of the Trans Am,
Firebird,
comes over to you and changes your sort of outlook on life.
Yeah, I was standing in an alley at 14 years old in 1987 and contemplating my life like most teenagers were. And I happened to be standing in the alley smoking a joint, and this Firebird came roaring down the alley, and it stopped, and the guy got out with a shaved head and with boots. And this was 87. Nobody really knew what a skinhead was. And he came over to me and he grabbed the joint from my mouth and crushed it with his boot. And he looked me in the eyes and he said, "Don't you know that that's what the communists and the Jews want you to do to keep you docile?" I was 14, man. I didn't know what a communist was. I didn't know if I'd met a Jewish person. I didn't even know what the word docile meant. I knew nothing about politics whatsoever. But this man, after talking to him for a while, who was twice my age at the time, he promised me paradise. And, you know, that might sound familiar for all different types of stories of, you know, whether you're joining a gang or, you know, flying to ISIS from middle America. he really promised me that I wouldn't be marginalized anymore, that I would be somebody. The racism didn't even register with me. It wasn't important to me. It was about belonging to this group and him saying my problems would go away.
What was next for you? I mean, after that point, after he says the problem's going to go away, I mean, you're 14 years old. I mean, yeah. you go back to school, right? I mean,
it was the summer. So I think it was the summer between eighth grade and freshman year. And I had that summer to think about it, to ride my little red bike up and down the alley, to go buy them cigarettes and get them, you know, beer, back when you can still do that without, you know, having to present an ID. And I got close. They drew me in and I started to dress like them. I started to listen to their music and I started to repeat the words that they said. And slowly that became my narrative. Actually, rather quickly, it became my narrative.
Well, you're 14 years old. And the narrative, I mean, the words that are used in the book, I mean, are just vile. I mean, you're sort of dumbed down, sensitive. This is some serious, this is white power at its most serious.
Yeah.
You talk about that, because, you know, there's one thing to have this sort of ethos and for Clark to come over, but the guy that recruited you, I mean, he's talking about he is really at the forefront of a white power neo-Nazi movement in the late 80s. It was unprecedented in the United States.
It was unprecedented. He was America's first neo-Nazi skinhead leader. And the neo-Nazi skinhead movement was born in Blue Island on the southwest side of Chicago in roughly 1985, 84. And here I was in 87 at 14 years old, and nobody had seen skinheads on, you know, Geraldo yet or Oprah. It happened that year, like 87 and 88, when people started to recognize it. But this man just, you know, I wanted to be like him. I didn't want to be me. I hated who I was because I felt very abandoned by my parents, because they were, when they came to the country, they wanted to work to support their family. I didn't see it that way. I just felt abandoned. I didn't, you know, I know that now. So I started to do things to scream for attention, and I ended up hating other people because I really hated myself. I was projecting my own anger and insecurities onto other people so that I wouldn't feel that pain anymore.
Well, in the book, and you talk about, you know, Clark, the man who was the forefather of the American neo-Nazi movement, went to jail.
Yes.
He got a sentence, and it left a void. And you had 15, 16 years old?
Yeah,
stepped into that void.
At 16 years old, after Clark had gone to prison for a really violent hate crime against a female member of his same group, who they saw at a bus stop with a black man, they went to her apartment and beat her, pistol whipped her, and left her for dead, and painted a swastika on her wall with her own blood. And one of America's first hate crimes, if not the first, I believe. And they went to prison. A bunch of people went to prison. So here I was, this 16-year-old kid with 2 years under my belt in America's first neo-Nazi skinhead movement, and there was this leadership void. And being ambitious, being, you know, trying to be entrepreneurial like my parents were, I stepped in and I became very intoxicated with the power, or what I thought was power. It wasn't real power, wasn't real respect.
So what was the job? The job was to not only continue the teachings of Clark, but to be sort of a minister of propaganda, but also to enact violence.
Yeah, no, it was largely about propaganda. We were a very effective marketing arm of the movement at that time. And I started bands to be able to draw people in because of that, and it worked very well. But there was absolutely violence, a lot of street violence, actually. And not so much, funny enough, maybe not funny, but it wasn't against minorities. It was against other white people. It was people in anti-racist gangs, anti-racist skinhead gangs, that we would just end up fighting each other over and over. But our main mission was to spread this propaganda, conspiracy theories about how Jews controlled the media and finance, how, you know, we were that diversity was a code word for white genocide, and that if we didn't protect ourselves, the white race would die.
You know, like I said, it's a tough read. There's times when there's some very sensitive material and sensitive language in this book, because you lived it. Yeah. And it's 16 years old. I mean, it's amazing to me, because as time went on, you were able to not only do the things we just talked about, propaganda, even starting the bands, but that your power, you gained more power, and you protected the turf. It was not unlike what we have witnessed with gangs and other things in the city of Chicago. It was very similar, but it was under the idea of white power.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was just the thread that bound all of us together was that ideology. But it was for the exact same reasons that young people joined gangs. There was a lack of opportunity. There was a sense of power and, you know, masculine kind of adrenaline going. And I wrote the book in the language that I would have spoken right. at 14 or at 16 or at 18. So that was intentional.
And that's striking. That's that you know that as a reader. It's not like I'm thinking, oh, this is Christian writing it back. I mean, it gives you a better understanding of who you were at 15, 16 years
old. Yeah. I mean, this wasn't as much of an apology book for me, although I'm very shameful about the things that I did. It was really about putting it out there as genuinely as possible so that people could see how dangerous it was for a young person from a good family who had a lot of love around him to go down a really bad path and end up hurting other people. And then eventually realizing that what I had learned and what I had taught others was not something that was positive for the world.
Before we get to that, because we will get to that, because we got to for the hour, you know, The part that really struck me was as a 16-year-old ambitious leader of a pretty new American movement, the white supremacist movement, you were able to not only organize and recruit locally here in Chicago, but you became a focal point, if not a leader in the country. I mean, you were having meetings with you know, people from Minnesota, from Alabama, from North Carolina, wherever it was. But the idea of really sort of being a networker at the age of 16.
Yeah. You know, I would even go as far as to say international, because I was, you know, there were people trying to set up meetings with me from Libya that represented Muammar Gaddafi that wanted to potentially fund, you know, our revolution against the common enemy, which we thought was the Jewish people. And, you know, luckily I didn't participate in that one because it ended up being a sting operation by the Canadian intelligence community. But, you know, it was really, it gave me this intense feeling of power. And respect, but it was not real power. It was not respect because I was really destroying myself and everybody that I touched.
You had, and your relationships got worse. Your family, your parents, it was a complete meltdown. Yeah. It was hard for you to keep relationships with anybody. A lot of the people that you did have friendships with were under the guise of this kind of white supremacist movement. I mean, for all the things that you entered into this movement for, it still seemed to not sort of quench that thirst.
No, it was like drugs, right? I mean, you get a taste of it. It feels pretty good for a little while, and then you need more and more until it kills you, and it kills everybody around you. And I had to give up everything that was important in my life, just like a drug addict or just like an alcoholic or just like, you know, anybody who joins a gang, because I wanted to adopt this new family, this new identity. And I had to give up my real family. I had to give up my real friends and my real hobbies and all the things that I loved just to be able to hate. And it was a really, it was like a disease that spread really, really quickly and thankfully was able to pinpoint it before it took me over, like most of the people that I knew who went to prison or ended up dead.
Christian Picciolini's in studio with me. He's the author of Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead. He's going to be speaking in Skokie at the Ethical Humanist Society on March 5th. Let's take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. When we come back, you know, music played a big part of this. You founded a couple bands, some white power punk bands. A lot of the communication and the network was set up by obscure music, punk music that was a rallying cry for white power. Let's talk about that when we come back. And then let's also talk about your rehabilitation. I mean, what it takes to get out of the American skinhead movement. I mean, it's pretty intense. Christian Picciolini in studio with me tonight. He's my guest at the big table. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio tonight at the big table is Christian Picciolini. He's the he's the author of Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead. He is a rehabilitated, reformed American neo-Nazi skinhead who wrote the book, from Blue Island. And as you said earlier in the show, I mean, really, the Blue Island, Illinois lays claim to, you know, the start of a neo-Nazi movement here in this country. I mean, back in the mid 80s.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's enough's enough. The hair metal band and and the birthplace of the neo-Nazi skinhead movement.
Those are the two.
In the U.S.
You know, it's interesting, and I want to bring this up because we talked about, you know, we're going to move on with the story because I want to get to the point when the breaking point for you. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Mary texts in. She's got a great question at 847. She says, as a teenager deep down inside, when you were alone and not around the rest of the group, did you truly believe the things that you were being taught?
I had doubts every day about the ideology. Every day. You know, I wasn't raised that way. It wasn't a foundation of who I was. It was something that I learned how to do and eventually unlearned how to do and, you know, took accountability and responsibility for the actions that I took. And I've spent the last 20 years of my life really trying to pull out. I'm still pulling out the weeds from all those seeds of hate that I planted, you know, 30 years ago. And which is why I've dedicated the last, you know, 20 years of my life to making sure that other young people don't go down the same path that I did.
You know, it is interesting because I think about the book and the stories that you tell. And, you know, there is this kind of idea of, you know, a lot of you think of people who are overcome by racism, mm-hmm. or intolerance. They may have had something personal happen to them.
Sure.
You know, I had an uncle who couldn't stand African-Americans because his relative was mugged,
right,
by a black man.
Right.
In your case, that's not necessarily what it was. I mean, it wasn't just sort of like, you know, I hate you know, gays, or I hate blacks, or I hate Jews because I have this personal experience. This is all just ethos. This is just something that was taught to you down at 14 years of age.
Yeah, no. I mean, the worst thing that happened to me was a couple of weeks after that alley meeting when I was smoking a joint and I met Clark Martell. I was riding my little red bike to Little League practice, and three black kids jumped me, beat me up, and stole my bike. And that made everything fall into place and make sense. I could blame everything now in the world that was going wrong on black people and Jews and everybody. That gave me license to do that. And it's the most ridiculous notion, because we know white kids steal bikes. We know Latino kids steal. I mean,
and in Blue Island, I mean, there's a little bit of, in the 80s, Blue Island, people are jumping people for the bikes.
That's just Blue Island. I think that's what Blue Island teenagers did back then. So yeah, I mean, it really took an almost very benign incident to confirm everything that I'd been confused about and that I'd been being fed now for a couple of weeks, to legitimize that idea. And all of a sudden it became me against them.
You know, Clark and Blue Island, mm-hmm. and your experiences shaped you, but also punk rock music shaped you, white power punk rock music. I think of, is it Screw Work? Is that
Screwdriver?
Screwdriver.
Yeah, no, it spoke to me.
So this was a punk band from Ian Stewart and the guys from Lund, or from Britain.
Yeah,
it was, and they were
England's, or the world's most popular white power band, the forefathers of it, really.
And so they were that became sort of a way. I mean, the way that you would start to get tapes and you'd be able to listen to the stuff, and the lyrics were a lot of protecting the Great White Way.
Yeah,
and a lot of sort of xenophobic policies in Europe. At the time in the 80s. I mean, this stuff became the rallying cry, and you were able to be almost a distributor here in the States and in America, and a way to take over what Clark was doing to get that music in the hands of potential neo-Nazi skinheads.
Music is a really powerful tool, and it doesn't matter if it's being used for racism or for love or for drugs or for whatever you want. It speaks to people. It brings you back to a certain time. It invokes emotions. It does all kinds of crazy things. So that music spoke to me. It was very noble. Its lyrics were about protecting, you know, your culture and being a Viking and you know, just this sense of honor it instilled in you. But that was also propaganda teaching you what we're calling now fake news, right? Mm-hmm. It was all about conspiracy theories. It was all about, you know, blaming others for the problems that you were experiencing rather than taking accountability for what might be the mess that you created. And it gave me license to be violent. It gave me license to be angry. And it was a very powerful tool that I recognized early. And that's why I started one of America's first white power bands.
You did, yeah. And talk about Way, the band that you, what was, I mean, you were a singer. So talk about, like, what drew you? What was it all about, sort of being a conduit, being a minister of propaganda?
You know, I didn't know how to play an instrument, so I just decided to be the singer of this band because I was very influenced by this music that was coming from England and from Europe. And And it made me feel powerful when I was on stage. So I would write lyrics denying the Holocaust or talking about, you know, the proud white legacy of our Viking ancestors. And
all stuff you didn't really know anything about.
I'm Italian. Like, I don't know very many Italian Vikings. But at that point in my life, I thought it was important. And, you know, it was a great tool to get young people together. It was like,
come to the show.
Come to the show. Yeah. Drink beer. There's girls. It was a great way to convene people, young people, and bring them into a message. It was a great tool.
And you had the ability, I mean, with the band and the band after that, to really move into a white power punk music lexicon. Like, you not only playing with the bands that were the only bands here in the States, mm-hmm. but you were invited to play, and you have a story of playing in Germany to thousands of neo-Nazis who are, you're on stage, and there it's Heil Hitler back and forth. I mean, talk about that. I mean, you reflect in the book about the power of that, but how does that memory, that thing that happened to you, how does it resonate with you?
You know, being a 17-year-old person and being in America's first white power band to ever leave the U.S. and play in a foreign country to 4,000 people, imagine being a 17-year-old kid who's insecure, who has low self-esteem, that's only bolstered by this false sense of power, now standing on a stage in front of 4,000 skinheads from all over Europe. And they're chanting your name. They don't speak your language, but they're singing your lyrics. And they're all buying you beer. And you're a hero in your own mind. At 17 years old, at that moment, it was the pinnacle of my life. Mm-hmm. I never thought I could be smarter, stronger, better, nothing. And that just kept feeding me with this power, I guess, this false sense of respect. And I played on that. And that's what kept me in, because ideologically, like the person who texted in, I had questions every day about the ideology. I question it now whether I even believed any of it to a degree. I was certainly violent because of it. I'm responsible for the acts that I committed and for all the people who I've, you know, co-opted their lives and who knows what happened to them. But at that time, I thought I was doing the right thing. I really thought I was saving the world. I thought that what I was doing was, you know, contributing to the greater good. But I always had these moments where I was like, really? Is that really what, you know, I want to do? Does that make me happy? Is that, you know, how is that affecting the other person? I had these flashes of empathy throughout those 8 years. And that kind of came to a head during a violent act when, you know, I was in a McDonald's with some of my friends late at night. And we walked in and there were these three black teenagers standing in line. And I, you know, loudly said, "This is my effing McDonald's, get out." And we chased them out. And as we chased them, one of them pulled out a gun. One of the black teenagers pulled out a gun and started shooting at us, and the gun jammed. And when we caught this guy, we beat him brutally. And this is a moment that still comes up in my mind and I think about quite often. As I was kicking him, I looked in his eyes and I thought, this could be my brother. This could be somebody that I love or care
about. Yeah,
your
younger brother, yeah.
Yeah. And how is this affecting this person's family? I had this connection during one of my most violent moments. And that was the last time I committed an act of violence. I really started to then, that was the catalyst that really allowed me to question what I was doing and why I was doing it.
After you had a child, mm-hmm. and you were 19, 20 years old.
19.
You started to question your role, mm-hmm. in the neo-Nazi skinhead movement, especially in Blue Island. You gave more power to other people. You started to get work in construction. Mm-hmm. You opened up your own record store. You know, it's interesting because as you went up and you're at that peak in your mind with this false power on stage in front of, you know, people who don't speak your language but are shouting your lyrics back to you.
Yeah.
The way down and out was not easy. There was a lot of not only sort of, you know, all the things that you held dear, how tough you were, how much power you had, all that stuff started to sort of come back to bite you in the ass.
Yeah, I was faced with this ideology that I didn't believe, because when I held my child, I finally had something to love, and all I had known for 8 years was hate, even for myself. So I knew that that wasn't what I wanted to do, but I also knew that it was going to be extremely difficult to give up everything that I had built during those 8 years. I mean, my whole identity was that movement. Every single one of my formative teenage years was spent in that movement. I also
expelled from schools. I mean,
six of them. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you,
one of them twice.
Yeah.
And here I had this, you know, this loyal family that had followed me and done anything I wanted them to do. And I had this power and this purpose, and I had to give up all of that. And when I gave that up, because I started to meet the people that I hated and I started to humanize them, when I opened the record store, people would come in to buy the other music that I was selling besides the white power music. Mm-hmm. I was selling hip hop and punk and heavy metal. And I began to meet the people that I hated for the first time in my life. And after a while, after they kept coming back, even though they knew who I was, they kept having these personal conversations with me. And I started to realize that, you know, we had the same fundamental needs, joys, fears, hates, and we needed each other. I bonded with them when they felt pain. And when I saw the gay couple with their child, I knew that they felt the same love that I felt for my own.
And in a way, you became a little bit of the enemy of your own movement.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, when I started to receive compassion that I least deserved it from, when I least deserved it, that's what made my change. But it also pitted me against the people that I was closest to. I became the ultimate traitor at that point when I decided to walk away.
Christian Piccolini is my guest tonight. He's the author of Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead. Really, his story as a teenager, being in the beginnings of the neo-Nazi movement here in America, and how he has rehabilitated. We'll come back, and you know, I want to wrap up your story and your rehabilitation. I want to get your thoughts on what we're seeing today. I mean, alt-right movement, so many people talking about white supremacy and white supremacists in office, and it's a lot of the threads and trends and narratives that are in this book are things that I have noticed in the last year.
Well, that's because we started it 30 years ago.
Christian Piccolini in studio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest at the big table tonight, Christian Piccolini. We're talking about his book, Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead. He's going to be speaking in Skokie at the Ethical Humanist Society on March 5th, talking about his role and leadership of a neo-Nazi movement, skinhead movement here in Chicago, in Blue Island, Illinois. You know, as we sort of wrap up, I mean, there's Life After Hate. I want to talk about that because that's really sort of the ad. That's the sort of peace, not-for-profit organization that you founded. You know, a lot of what we talked about, your family, you know, moving away from the ideology, but also in a situation, and you mentioned it about, you know, when you were having that violent incident and you thought about your brother. Your brother was a big part of your life because a lot of the things that you lived through and turned into who you were, your brother experienced as well.
Yeah. You know, when I walked away in 96, I tried to run away from my past. I didn't want to really talk about it. I tried to make new friends, and I moved and all kinds of stuff. I didn't have the courage to face it, so I tried to outrun it. And then I met a man who convinced me, and this is somebody who I had hurt, convinced me that I needed to tell my story. So I started to think about it, and I started to tell people, and things started to get better, but I still didn't find the courage to really go public about it. And then one night in 2004, in the middle of the night, I got a call that my younger brother had been shot and killed. And he was in a neighborhood in the wrong place at the wrong time, and somebody was threatened by his skin color. I knew at that point that I needed to really tell my story because I thought that people could learn from my mistakes. And, it was a really tough waking
That's
up.
That's hard.
Moment
I mean, reading the book, and it's structured that way that your brother played a pivotal role in your life.
Yeah.
You know, as being a younger brother who looked up to you, and when the points when you really didn't think about wanting to stay in this world and
And he tried to follow in my footsteps, you know, not necessarily ideologically, but he wanted to have the same legacy that I did.
The power, everything, right?
And I wasn't there for him when he needed me, and I blamed myself for a really long time for his death. But I do feel very responsible for every young person because my story is everybody's story, potentially. Every young person is searching for identity. They're searching for purpose. They're looking for that community. And there are people, a lot of people, who will intercept them when they're the most vulnerable because that's what they're looking for, and they'll draw them into bad things.
You said 30 years ago you started a movement. You even talked a little bit about the toxic weeds that are still sort of growing from that movement.
Yeah,
we've seen a lot of it. This talk of white supremacy and even anti-Semitic behavior.
Sure.
We saw more bomb threats at Jewish community centers today. I mean, when you see this stuff as someone who has reformed skinhead, neo-Nazi skinhead, when you see this stuff that's being played out in mainstream threads and media, what's your take? I mean, is this real? Is it fake? Is it what's happening?
It's like my life is from 30 years ago is flashing before my eyes again. I can tell your audience right now, 30 years ago, we were involved very heavily in changing the strategy of our movement. We recognized that by waving swastikas and shaving our heads and getting tattoos, we were scaring away a lot of potential members for our organization, or at least ideologically related folks. So we said 30 years ago, we need to stop shaving our heads, stop getting the tattoos, stop marching with swastika flags. Instead, we need to grow our hair, wear a suit and a tie, go to school, go to university, blend in, become a cop, run for office, all these things that we're now seeing today with these, what we're calling the alt-right. And I'm just going to tell your listeners right now, make no mistake, those people who call themselves the alt-right are neo-Nazis. Their ideology is the same. They've just massaged a message and they've made it more palatable for the mainstream masses to accept.
You know, it's interesting, you know, when you talk about that, because you talk about the politicians and you know, the party that's in control. And I don't mean the Republican Party, but the alt-right movement shows a lot of the same things that you're talking about in the book. Also, you know, the neighborhoods that you talk about, Blue Island, Beverly, Mount Greenwood, I mean, they are strong Trump neighborhoods. And a lot of those people who are from that area have similar thing. I don't want to typecast everybody because that's not the case. But from your vantage point, from the 80s and 90s, there are a lot of people that you were able to recruit from those neighborhoods.
Yeah, I have a lot of former friends, let's say, that went into law enforcement in those areas. And I have a deep respect for law enforcement and for police officers and firemen and what they do. And certainly isn't a reflection on all of them. But, you know, there were members who were skinheads who just, you know, a couple of years after they were skinheads became Chicago cops or went into, you know, different suburbs and are prison guards and things like that. These are, you know, they've definitely infiltrated. I know that there are people who have not changed. They just move from one power structure to another.
They're just seeking power.
Yeah.
You know, Christian, it's interesting because you talked about having that conversation with the man who said, you have to tell your story.
Yeah.
And you said, it's hard to tell the story. Because at the end of the day, not unlike just what you just said, as people are seeking from power to power, I mean, so when you tell people I was a leader, I wasn't just a minion.
Right.
I was a leader of a white supremacist movement in the 80s and 90s. How did they react?
You know, that's the reason I started Life After Hate, because of how people react to that, because there was never anybody who had spoken out about it. There had been people who'd spoken out but never provided the support needed for people to leave. Because when people leave an organization like that with a, you know, with an ideology and with a, you know, community atmosphere and a purpose, you have to give them something else. So I started Life After Hate to help people become supported and feel better about themselves so they don't have to use the racism as a crutch. It's interesting. When I work with neo-Nazis, I never talk ideology with them, or I try not to. Instead, I listen because they always tell me the clues on what's missing in their life that led them down that path to begin with. It could be poverty. It could be mental illness. It could be, you know, a grievance of some sort. And I work to fill those holes. And it's funny because when they become more stable, when they feel better about themselves, the racism falls away because they don't have to blame anybody else for the problems that they had. Now they're responsible for their own problems. And, you know, it's like kind of magical how the ideology just washes away.
It's interesting because these threads that play out really are about a teenage boy who is looking to belong.
Yeah.
And you know, the ideology that in your life was a white power structure that came in that manipulated you and said, hey, you know, this is what you believe. I hear the story and I think about gangbangers in Inglewood, drug dealers on the West Side.
Young girls from Middle America who fly to Syria to join ISIS.
And it makes me think, I mean, you know, from the kid who just got arrested for shooting the 11-year-old girl to, like you just said, to ISIS and what we see with suicide bombings and people who fly. I mean, really, at the end of the day, this is a larger issue than just sort of being indoctrined or manipulated into an ideology.
Yeah, and this may not be a popular sentiment, but every one of those people you just mentioned was a victim at some point in their lives. They weren't born to be suicide bombers. They weren't born to be drug dealers or gangbangers or neo-Nazis. Something happened. There was a lack of opportunity. There was a lack of leadership. There was a lack of somebody for them to look up to. For some reason, they went down that path. And until we solve the opportunity problem, we're going to continue to see people going down every extremist path imaginable.
Let me ask you a quick question as we wrap up here. And I don't want to get so deep right at the end. But, I mean, you know, for you to think back, to have these memories, to collect them in this memoir, do they haunt you? I mean, do you know, I saw your face when you were telling the story about the violent incident with the kid who shot at you. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you think about all the violence and the experiences you were involved in, those memories come back in conversations like this. What does it do to you?
Every time I turn on the news and I hear about a Dylann Roof walking into a church in South Carolina and murdering 9 innocent people, or a Wade Michael Page in a Sikh temple in Wisconsin, or the bomb threats at Jewish community centers, I feel very responsible for that. Because 30 years ago, I put those ideas out into the world, and I know that they are still spreading. And every time I hear about that, I feel as though I helped create that. My music is still out there. And now it's why I've dedicated the last 20 years of my life to really trying to help people find a different narrative and a different perspective.
Christian Piccolini is the author of Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead. He does run the group Life After Hate, a peace advocacy nonprofit helping people who may have been indoctrined or want to get out of the life of being a neo-Nazi skinhead. He's speaking in Skokie at the Ethical Humanist Society on March 5th. Christian, thanks so much for coming in and being my guest tonight. I appreciate it. Thanks for telling your story.
My pleasure, Justin. I'm going to head back out into the hallway, see if I could catch up with David Axelrod again.
He's out here. Christian, thanks for being here. All right. So there you go. Good conversation right there. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest has a pretty boring office job. He works 9 to 5, sometimes goes in on weekends. So, you know what? I got the wrong intro here. No, my next guest is an environmental anthropologist and one-time National Geographic Explorer of the Year. I'm talking about cave diver Kenny Broad. Kenny Broad takes his work seriously because he goes to places that we can't. And one false move, and, well, Kenny Broad wouldn't be here tonight. Broad's explored everything from venomous snakes in Vietnam to underwater caves in the Bahamas, and he's worked on every single continent on this planet. Intrigued? Kenny Broad is in Chicago for a conversation at the Goodman Theater tomorrow night, part of the National Geographic Live series. The event is called The Risky Science of Exploration, and he is in studio tonight. Kenny Broad, thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
Hey, thank you, Justin.
Environmental anthropologist. What is that? When I think of you, I think explorer, right? I mean, what's an environmental anthropologist?
It's a great title for someone with attention deficit disorder because if you get stuck in one subject, you can switch to another, and you can go from the physical sciences to what I would argue are the harder sciences, the social sciences, where you have to deal with people and how the two interact, because they really are connected.
And I want to ask the simple question, but why did you want to be an explorer? But even more, I read in your bio, you've done some commercial diving in your life. Talk about that. Talk about the idea of, as an adult, how you got into this work.
I think it's easy after the fact to make it sound rational, but the bottom line was I grew up in South Florida, so part of it is just circumstances where you're surrounded by water, and you're not just surrounded by the Atlantic Ocean on one side and actually the Everglades, which is a, you know, water-filled swamp on the other, but you have water beneath you. So we're on this thin, porous layer of limestone, and all our groundwater is beneath our feet. So, you know, it's sink or swim, and you know, I was able to ride my bike to the beach. It's free, and once you stick your head in the water with a pair of goggles, at least for me, it opened up a whole nother world.
It's amazing. I mean, to look at, do the research and I mean, all the stuff is available on YouTube, and you can see all the PowerPoint presentations you've done and some of the footage that you've collected. When you think about this, I mean, it seems like this is the final frontier when it comes to exploring. I mean, you are going into underwater caves and places that have never been touched before. I mean, is that the as an explorer, do you start to as you continue to do this work, just be like, all right, what have I not, what has nobody done?
I guess as I tell my students at the University of Miami, if you can't be smart, be first. So that's kind of been my approach. And then I just surround myself with smart people and try to get us all into a place that we don't know much about. And underwater caves, that you could probably make an argument they're one of the least explored ecosystems on our planet and probably for that reason one of the least understood. And there's lots of reasons to study them from scientific standpoints, but just from a purely selfish human standpoint, if you take away the water that's locked up in ice, mm-hmm. more than 95% of the world's groundwater, that's our fresh drinking water, is beneath our feet. And it's out of sight, out of mind, so we tend not to protect it properly.
For you, going into those spaces, I mean, it seems you had a whole piece about passion versus risk. And, I mean, these are not sanitized for your protection. I mean, these are entirely dangerous places with one false move and you get yourself caught. I mean, claustrophobia alone, I don't think, I know I could. I can't speak for Pete, but I feel like that alone would be enough for me to say, all right, you know what, we put someone put a camera down there, right?
I'm glad to hear that because it's good for job security for me. And I would be afraid if I had to host your show. So we'll stick to our
jobs. So talk
about
that. I mean, there is this passion versus risk. I mean, there's a lot of risk involved in this job. This is not a job that you walk away from unscathed.
There's a certain degree of cognitive dissonance or denial where, you know, if you put the risk at the center of it, you probably wouldn't do it. But the truth is we all consider ourselves risk managers in this mm-hmm. business. And objectively, a lot of times we worry about the cave-ins, the claustrophobia, the multiple failures of equipment. And those are the dramatic ones, the ones that come to mind. But objectively, the closer calls we've had, it's the car ride there. It's driving in foreign highways, or even worse, driving where I live in South Florida.
I think about Discovery Channel and some of the different cable channels that will host shows with explorers, whether it be people who are on the high seas or fishermen or any sort of extreme kind of naturalist. You know, when you see that, it's everything is high stakes and high energy because they pump that stuff up for the television. They have to have conflict and say, is it like, as an explorer, as someone who is going into places we've never seen before, is it like that? I mean, is it heart pounding, edge of your seat, commercial break kind of exploring?
No, that's exactly what you want to avoid, especially underwater, but even on the surface. Once you get your heart rate up, then your respiration rate goes up, and then all your diving gases go away quickly. So it's really more a mental game, and you're better off practicing, yoga and meditation and visualization than you are, pumping iron and getting macho. But I will say, what happens is you get these kind of, you really want boredom on an expedition, but things do happen. You put yourself in these situations. So it's all about training for those low probability, but sort of high impact challenges that come around.
Well, we're talking with Kenny Broad. He is an explorer and an environmental anthropologist. He's one-time National Geographic Explorer of the Year. He's going to be at the Goodman Theater tomorrow night. The event is called The Risky Science of Exploration. It's put on by National Geographic Live. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll do more with Kenny Broad here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio, the explorer, the environmental anthropologist, Kenny Broad, one-time National Geographic Explorer of the Year. He is in town for a conversation at the Goodman Theater tomorrow night. The event is called The Risky Science of Exploration, put on by National Geographic Live. Starts at 7 o'clock tomorrow night at the Goodman. You know, we're talking about this concept of what we know to be exploration really being hyped up by the media or people putting together cable shows about this stuff and the reality of it. I have to ask a question because you mentioned a little bit earlier about the idea of underwater caves are really the least explored part of our world. Are there parts of our world that explorers have never touched? I mean, are we out? Are explorers having to go around again for a second time now?
Not only are there places that we know very little about, so the bottom of the ocean, and the analogy is we know more about the moon, the surface of the moon, than the bottom of the ocean. Certainly underwater caves in general. But there's a lot of places that we can now go back to where we've been, but we have new techniques, whether it's low-cost DNA analysis, whether it's all different sorts of scientific analytical techniques. And we have a much different purpose where before And I think this is what differentiates adventure from exploration. Before, let's get to the top, just get to the top, or the deepest point to get to the deepest point. But we tend to go now with missions, and they tend to be about understanding the world we live in and geared towards some kind of modern problem, whether it's water management, whether it's climate change.
So there's more conservation. Change. There's more more idea of looking at how this affects the planet or what's happening with the planet as opposed to just race to the top.
Yeah, definitely more of an applied science. And that, again, that goes back to your other question. These are expeditions that are highly planned, choreographed. These aren't thrill-seeking, adrenaline junkie sorts of endeavors.
But, I mean, there is. I mean, you know, just the fact that you know you're in a space that's as big as this, the desk I'm sitting at, and you're wiggling yourself through. I mean, there is something to be said about. Yes, there is high stakes on this. It's not just boredom. There's something that's extremely, extremely dangerous.
Sure. I mean, I will admit that if you put yourself in a water-filled hole with no oxygen and only one way in, one way out, and you lose all visibility, it has its risks.
You've had a tremendous career, not only doing underwater stuff. You've done other things too, like chasing venomous snakes in Vietnam, and actually doing anthropology at the level of tracking cocaine and cocaine smugglers and producers and dealers in Jamaica. I mean, you've done so many different things. Is there a type of exploration that you like more than the other?
I think it's the diversity, and that's what's great about the field of anthropology. It really is truly interdisciplinary, and you can go from the physical sciences to the natural sciences. You can go from esoteric, philosophical, moral problems about how we manage our resource. Mm-hmm. It's easy to say don't cut down the trees, but if those are the trees that sustain people's livelihoods by being able to just cook their food in the most basic sense, we really need to understand the cultural side as well as the physical side.
There's so much that's happening, when I think of the world, even the stories that you covered, whether it be drugs in Jamaica or snakes in Vietnam. When doing this kind of stuff, what do you have to do to prepare for any sort of mission? I mean, is it months and months of academic research to get ready to go into an underwater cave, or is it more like, cave, jump?
Well, I have to admit, if I see a cave, I'm willing to jump, just because that's my main thing. But certainly for the topics where you have, it's a new research subject, the most important thing is the background research by getting in touch with the people who've done the work there, and by really working out who are the local communities who live around there, what's a fair partnership to work with them on this problem, because we're not going to reinvent the wheel. These are people who've adapted to their circumstances, who are most affected by it. So this, the colonial idea, the white man explorer coming in and finding it, those were naive back then. They're even more ridiculous now.
Well, I was thinking about this today that, a lot of exploration throughout our time, at least in American history, has been documented, whether it be Lewis and Clark or any other explorers. They've come up with maps. They've been able to tell the story of their adventure or their exploration. In your case, technology has increased dramatically in the way that every time you see a picture of you in a cave, you've got a huge camera with you in a video. I mean, a lot of this is about mapping and understanding it for other people to see, not just for you in the moment to see around you. So talk about how technology has changed your job as an explorer.
I think what originally to me was the burden of having to bring cameras along, and I worked with, it's really almost a seamless sort of interaction between scientists, the explorers, and the camera crews. And to get into some of these specialized places like underwater caves, you need explorers who know how to use the cameras, et cetera. So it's really interesting, sort of a cross-disciplinary teams where everyone learns and is reliant on each other. So I've learned to sort of embrace it. I would say the challenge is the balance of, you can only get so much done in a day. You only get so many dives. So how much of it do you put into capturing the imagery versus how much goes into the science? And, there's tension on these expeditions, but people understand, hey, if we don't come back with pictures, then people don't learn about it. And people, I think we could all agree, people don't necessarily learn from facts. They learn from how they're emotionally driven. And it's the pictures and the stories that drive people.
Well, I mean, even this series that you're doing, the National Geographic Live, which you're on stage tomorrow at the Goodman, that's part of this is what we've learned. This is sort of take a look at these great pictures we've taken. This is I can give context to what you're seeing as opposed to flipping through a magazine or something like that.
National Geographic is probably the only organization I know of that not only supports the science, but then also supports the capturing of imagery and then gives you a platform to talk about these things. I mean, I'm at the University of Miami where you know, we have lots of opportunities mm-hmm. to talk to people, but it's not this sort of platform that we can work with National Geographic, and that's one of the big advantages.
You know, I think so much about what we know about exploration, and you're right, it's married with science, and there are different teams. Do you see exploration staying in the world of academia, or do you see a world in which commercial or private interest get involved in funding what you guys do and how you guys do it?
You know, there's always been private investment in exploration from the early days. But, you know, you have SpaceX. I think mm-hmm. in many ways it's moving in the big bucks more into the private sector support. That said, the flip side of it, there's a certain democratization of exploration going on with the availability of what just a decade ago were extremely expensive technologies, such as remotely operated vehicles, drones, etc., that now anyone can get hold of. Hmm. And on top of that, there's organizations and structures where you can contribute your data to a larger, right, you know, right, well-organized right. scientific purpose. So the age of citizen science is here in a meaningful way. There's still a lot of questions yeah. and challenges to
well,
it.
Well, there's a lot of danger as well. I mean, I guess your services, because as an explorer, as someone who has done this kind of stuff, I mean, people are always going to need your services, even if they replace the scientists with different interests, right?
Yeah, I think the danger is less people who have a sort of genuine interest in contributing to the scientific endeavor than it is the GoPro. You know, I got mm-hmm. my GoPro. I'm going to get on YouTube, and I'm going to jump off this building because right. I saw a guy right. in a squirrel suit do it.
Is that something that you and your colleagues think about? I mean, the idea that you're almost down in this cave, and you take a left turn, and you could die, and then you're like, people are like, I can do that.
You know, I think the history of cave diving has been one of learning trial and error from accidents, from deaths. And the cave diving community and the diving community in general, they're pretty good at advertising that this is not, you know, you don't go in there without the right training. And truth be told, most people don't want to hack through a jungle. Most people don't, you know, you really got to go.
That's actual work.
You really got to go out of your way to kill yourself in a lot of the places we work. So, you know.
The last question I'll ask is just, you know, there's so much said about climate change, and we have this, it's somehow become a political issue. You being on the front lines where you're able to see in the oceans, in remote places of our planet, whether or not there is any sort of impact in the way that we have treated the planet over the years. Can you say, oh, I've been here and I came back and I can see the difference and I can understand climate change?
Without a doubt. And you see it. I mean, the interesting thing is I've been able to see it on the surface in many places. But more interestingly, and this is part of the research we do, is in underwater caves. One of the things we never think about, and one of the biggest impacts of climate change, is sea level rise. Mm-hmm. But sea level rise isn't just over the top of the beaches or the barriers or the walls. It's actually through the ground beneath our feet into our drinking water, the aquifers. So we're seeing saltwater intrusion in places that used to be completely fresh water. And then again, that's our lifeblood, our yeah. fresh water. So. And then the samples, we reconstruct past climate from stalagmites. Those are the cave formations. And we see at very high resolution what's happened in the past. And all of that adds up to, you know, it's changing rapidly now, and we know why.
Kenny Broad is my guest. He is in Chicago for a conversation tomorrow at the event called The Risky Science of Exploration, put on by National Geographic Live. He is an environmental anthropologist, one-time National Geographic Explorer of the Year, cave diver extraordinaire. Kenny Broad, it was a pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for taking
some
time out.
Me.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is bringing his style of soul, funk, and electronic music to the Lincoln Hall on February 23rd, Chicago. Time to warm up with the sounds of Sin Cane. That's the track Telephone off the new album Life and Living It. Syncane is actually a project headed up by multi-instrumentalist and producer Ahmed Jalab. He was born in London. He lived in Sudan as a young boy. He came here to the United States, grew up in Ohio, and he's currently based in New York City. This is the sixth album, and he's getting great reviews for not just the music, which is always spectacular, but the message, a much more socially conscious record this time around. Ahmed had quite a couple years leading the Atomic Bomb Band, which included David Byrne from Talking Heads, Money Mark from the Beastie Boys, and Pat Mahoney from LCD Sound System, just to name a few. Like I said, Syncane will be on stage at the Lincoln Hall on the 23rd, and Ahmed joins me now. Ahmed, thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. You got all of that right.
Good, good. We worked hard on it. Talk about the new music. You know, for you, I kind of talked about this. You know, the music is evolving, and it really is. It's such a great record. But talk about, you know, what you were trying to accomplish with Life and Living It.
You know, when I started writing the album, it was really important for me to try to accomplish two goals. One of it was to have a lot of fun. And the second was to write about my experiences. The whole goal of Syncane for me is to connect with people. You know, people who are like me, children of the second generation diaspora, people who live in the United States but aren't from here, you know, or are part of an expat community and grew up with the struggles and times that comes with, you know, mm-hmm. and also people who aren't like me, but also share a similar sentiment. So I thought if I talked about my personal experience, I could connect with a lot of people and relate with them on all of the things that I wanted to talk about.
I read an article that you struggle with the idea of home because you'll go to the Sudan and it doesn't really feel like home, or you'll be in the United States and it doesn't feel like home. Talk about that concept, you know, about trying to find a place.
Yeah, so my family moved to the United States when I was 5 years old. And, you know, up until I moved to New York 8 years ago, I hadn't lived anywhere for longer than 4 years. So it was constantly moving around. And you live in with your family and you kind of like are living among this culture that they're trying to preserve within the family home. And then you go out to school and none of your friends share a similar upbringing, or you're the only, you know, I was living in Utah for a while, but literally the only black kid there. And I'd go back to Sudan, and just right when I'd get comfortable, I'd have to move back to the States to go back to school. And it allowed me to grow up with an open mind, you know, because I got to see how a lot of different people experience the world and how a lot of young kids grew up and experience the things that you do when you grow up, you know. Although I had like a tough time understanding my identity, I feel like I've come out of it learning that there really aren't that many answers out there, and it's important to just kind of blaze your own trail and trust in yourself and come to really love the fact that you are different.
Talking about your upbringing and your background musically, I mean, one of the great things about Syncane and the work that you've done throughout your career has just been how eclectic the music is. You borrow from a lot of different traditions. You bring a lot of different kinds of music to the forefront that don't always necessarily go together. Do you think that has something to do with the fact that you move from place to place every 4 years?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, one of the things that I came to understand from moving around and befriending many different kinds of people all over the U.S. and Sudan is that really we're all the same, you know? The thing is, like, we all, like, experience love and hate and nostalgia and sadness and joy all in a very similar way. You know, we're all connected by those feelings. And growing up, I listened to so many different kinds of music, and I realized that those sentiments were shared by the people who started all of those kinds of music. So people, you know, poor oppressed people in Jamaica, poor white people in the United States, black people in the United States, and Africans, they all share a similar understanding of joy, of sadness, and a similar struggle. And when they put that energy into making their own music, it comes off very similarly, you know, and it's all interconnected. And I thought it'd be really interesting to kind of take all of those energies and create something unique with them, you know, because they all share a similar thing.
We're talking with musician Ahmed Jalab. He is the man behind Syncane, which is coming to Lincoln Hall on February 23rd. I mean, it's interesting, too, because you had with the Atomic Bomb Band, the band that you've been the band leader and the music director for, which has almost been a super group of, and talk about the band, but you have brought together and been able to work with people with such diverse backgrounds to create something new. When you listen to that music and it's based off of the Nigerian musician, but you can hear it. There's so much, it's so eclectic in what you guys bring together. Does everything you just talked about, that's got to help when being able to organize that music with such big personalities involved in the band?
Yeah, I mean, the Atomic Bomb Band thing was a lot of fun for me because it was kind of like there's so much energy that comes with that territory. Like being on stage with Pharoah Sanders and David Byrne and Damon Albarn at the same time is like you're bursting at the seams. And it's really just up to me to mold that into something digestible for people because it's so much, you know? And it was a lot of fun because it was like a dream come true. Any musician would want to be in that situation. And it also gave me the confidence to move into making this album because before I did that project, people like Pharoah Sanders and David Byrne and Damon Albarn and Hot Chip and all those guys, they just seemed like they were a part of this club that I was trying to get into, you know? They were way over here and I was way in the back, like trying to poke my head out saying, hey guys, I'm over here, right? And I got the acknowledgement from them and I got the respect from them and we all became friends. And once that happened, it made me really excited to make a new record and it made me confident about my ideas and my ability.
Well, and one of the things in the new record, we kind of talked about it in the intro, is that, and no disrespect to the music before it, you've evolved with the music, but the music was really the centerpiece. I mean, there was something great about this almost dance music that you were creating. This record takes the dance music and brings in a socially conscious approach to the lyrics and to the issues of the day. Is that something that you learned from being around, gaining confidence, being around the other musicians who have somewhat made a career doing that?
Yeah, but also, you know, I have a songwriting partner that I work with, Greg LaFaro, who's one of my oldest friends, and he writes a lot of the lyrics. You know, on the album, he wrote all the lyrics to the songs except for one song with Jason Trammell from our band, The Drummer, wrote. And him and I, for the past three records, what we do is we talk about all of the issues that we are hoping to discuss with the album. And he does such a great job of picking my brain and, you know, whenever I come up with an idea, he really tries to understand what am I truly trying to say. And he really gets into the nitty-gritty with me. And then he'll come back with these amazingly eloquent lyrics, you know, and we'll talk about them even more, really work on it a lot. And I think after two records, him and I really got to a great place, and he really challenged himself, and I challenged him to really become super concise about what he was writing, you know. And in turn, it challenged me to understand exactly what I wanted to say, you know.
This has got to be a strange time. I mean, having a Sudanese background, and Sudan being one of the countries that was in the Trump administration's travel ban. Talk about, you know, just everything that's happening right now in America, especially when it comes to just this idea that what we stand for and immigration, all the things that have come before are sort of being challenged. And you actually are a representation of someone who's lived in London, Sudan. You talked about just moving around the United States of America. What's your thought on what has transpired in the last month and how, from your vantage point as an artist, what it means?
Well, when my family emigrated to the United States in 1989, the U.S. government granted us asylum and recognized that we were fleeing from a very terrible situation. And I'm absolutely thankful for that. And I feel growing up in the United States, even though I don't feel 100% American, I do feel American, you know? And when I see this kind of response to the world from a new president, it doesn't seem American to me. You know, it just seems like exposing insecurities and just talking fear, you know, into everyone. You know, that's America is an open place. It's an accepting place, and it was created by immigrants, you know. So it's frustrating to see this happen, but what I've seen transpire out of all of this kind of hate is a lot of people coming together to say that this is not who we are. This isn't the America that we know, you know? It was so overwhelming receiving emails and phone calls from my friends asking how I was and how my family was, you know? And also seeing people at JFK here in New York and at the court office like challenge the executive order. It's been pretty amazing to see how people beyond New York are responding to it as well. And even the Women's March, of course, too, you know. There are more people coming together out of all of this than I think anyone has realized, and it's really exciting, and I'm very hopeful for the future.
Musician, multi-instrumentalist, producer Ahmed Jalab, his band Sinkane is going to be at Lincoln Hall on February 23rd. Ahmed, thanks so much for taking some time out to talk to us tonight, and congrats on the great reviews for the record.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Well, I'm the first to say.
There's some good stuff there. At Lincoln Hall, coming up on Thursday. All right, Studio 435 tonight. I'm very excited about this. Material reissued live in studio, performing live. Oh, man. I just talked to them in the green room during the news, and they do remember that show. It was at the China Club down on Lake Street, or one of those right there. And they also told me that they also stayed up all night. So that worked out really well that we both were up all night. It was a Q101 thing. And it was one of those things where they put six or seven bands together. And the bands then all played one song. But I was too naive about how that kind of stuff worked. And I don't ever remember that being a thing. I never went to a jingle bash in my life. So I don't know why, but I thought like, oh, it was going to be like full sets. So like I had brought, it was a very interesting time for me because I had brought a bunch of people from my old high school, from McHenry High School, showed up at my apartment in Chicago. And so we all hung out all night. And it was a lot, some people I had not seen since graduation. And it was probably a year and a half later. And it was kind of a strange moment to be like, well, I created a whole new life in Chicago, and without these people now, there were 15, 20 people back in in my apartment, my two-bedroom apartment. Three-bedroom. It's three-bedroom. I don't want to sell it short. The rent was that of a studio apartment. It was like my part was $150, whatever. And I remember we stayed up all night because I think the thing started at 6 o'clock in the morning. We were kids. We were all, you know, sophomores in college or whatever, juniors, so it was probably a Tuesday. I remember it in my head like a Friday night, but it was probably a Tuesday. And I just remember being in that China Club and being like trying to keep my eyes open, waiting for Material Issue. Like, and Matt, they reminded me Matthew Sweet was on the gig too. Matthew Sweet, Material Issue, and like six other bands that probably had their one hit Q101 stuff on there. But we were there for Material Issue. It's not there for Matthew Sweet. Material Reissue in Studio 312 tonight.
Eddie Olczyk joins us to talk about the Blackhawks' surge to the playoffs. Tom Skilling tells us when the winter weather is going to return.
Shut up.
And Anna DeVlantis returns.
Wonderful woman. We're all very fond of her.
Good time with Anna DeVlantis. Chicago's conversation is on 720 WGN.
A lot has changed in the last few years. You've traded bar crawls in Wrigleyville for watching babies crawl in Naperville. Late night feedings no longer mean scarfing down tacos in Wicker Park, but preparing a bottle in Orland Park. And your monthly rent check has been replaced by a 30-year mortgage. But you wouldn't have it any other way, because you and your family have a home you love. Now, give that home the protection it deserves with Allstate House and Home Insurance. An Allstate agent can help you customize a policy for your home and get you extra savings when you bundle policies. So don't wait. Talk to an Allstate agent about the customized protection and savings of house and home insurance today.
Talk to a Chicagoland Allstate agent and save 10% when you sign up now. Coverage, discounts, and features are subject to terms, conditions, and availability. Discount applies to premium for major peril. Savings vary.
See what the personal service of an Allstate agent can do for you. Allstate, Chicago's own good hands.
Your doctor told you to use a CPAP machine for your sleep apnea. But did you know a dirty CPAP system can make you sick? Just one drop of water left inside your tubing or mask can become a breeding ground for mold and bacteria. Suddenly, your sleep solution turns into a nightmare. But now SoClean.com has released the world's first and only automated CPAP cleaner and sanitizer. It kills 99.9% of CPAP germs in minutes, and it's hands-free. To try it risk-free, call 1-800-700-5272.
SoClean is amazing. I had a cold I couldn't kick despite regularly washing the mask and antibacterial dish soap. 2 days after using SoClean, the cold was gone and hasn't returned.
SoClean destroys CPAP germs without any water, chemicals, or disassembly. Try it risk-free and see for yourself. Keep your doctor's orders, but ditch the germs. To get your risk-free 30-day trial while supplies last, call 1-800-700-5272. Hurry, that's 1-800-700-5272.
Coming up, material reissue in Studio 435. After that, 11 o'clock, Patty Vasquez takes over. Tonight, Nick DiGiulio has Tom Appella. We had him at the old auto show. Tom of the Consumer Guide Automotive answers your questions and recaps the best of the auto show on Nick tonight. That's 2:10 a.m. If you're in the market for a new or used car, Tom's your guy. That's great. I had a lot of fun with that conversation. We really got into it. I was just like on fire. Let's just throw in all these questions there. I read this one thing, Tom. That's what that segment should be called. I read this article, Tom. The automotive industry. Not an industry I've paid that much attention to in my life. But I am intrigued on what happens next. A lot of reading around for that story about what the industry expects from the Trump administration, so forth. That was fun at the auto show on Friday. We had fun.
And you're in the market for a new car. You kind of been sniffing around.
Let's not get, you know, you just woke up the vampires.
Oh, sorry.
Every dealership in Chicago is like, I can smell it. No, I am in the market. I have a 2000, I said 2004 on Friday, but it's a 2005. I want to sell myself short. So we're coming up on, I mean, it's now a 12-year-old car, but it's only got 100,000 miles on it. It's amazing to think about.
And it's not nickel and diming you yet.
No.
Another year or two.
No, I mean, I can take my time, and it's fully paid off the whole bit. So, and I will. It's got a cassette deck.
Cassettes are big now. They're back in style.
So there you go. There you go.
You use that as a selling point when you get rid of it.
Yeah. I'm going to trick it out so it's like, you know, only cassette singles. Belle Biv DeVoe, cassette singles. Cassette singles. Is that right?
Park it in, Logan.
Yeah.
And just, you know, for sale has cassette player.
Cassette player.
Thing's going to sell
it.
10 minutes.
You can play all of your Brandy singles. I saw this. Sam Panionovich just tweeted this out. I want to play a projected 2017 starting lineup for the Chicago White Sox. That was interesting, right? Because there's been all this talk about the young Turks, if you will, coming up. Zach Collins, I think it's Collins, the catcher. Zach Attack. Birdie, I don't know, B-U-R-D-I, the pitcher. Michael Kopech, Yael Moncada, Lucas Giolito.
I don't think those guys are going to be in the lineup.
None of those guys are in this lineup, but that's so scary. You're like, oh, this is so great. So much young talent. This is going to be great. And then you're like, oh, what? This is what they got. Charlie Tilson leading off in center field, which is pretty good. He's sort of been the guy that everyone's like, you should check this guy out. He came up for a game last year, if you remember this. He came up and in the process, and I can't remember if he got picked off or if he was running out of single or a double or something, he pulled his hamstring.
And the That's only, right. Yeah.
And it was like, remember, I think we were talking about face palm, you know. So he's projected leadoff. Tim Anderson, the shortstop, who had
good player.
Yeah. Jose Abreu, Melky Cabrera.
Solid.
Todd Frazier. Brett Lowry. So, you're like, okay, that's not that different than last year. I don't think there's much change except for Adam Eaton at the top. Then you've got, at catcher, Giovanni Soto. Now, you're like, oh, here we go, right? Oh, here we go.
Former Gio rookie Soto. Of the year, the Cubs guy?
But, you know, who they had last year was Alex Avila, and they, you know, have never had any, they've had no help at the catcher position. So, you know what? I mean, it's kind of a either the same or a little bit of an upgrade because he's got a better bat than Alex Avila. I don't know how good Gio Soto is at, you know, managing a pitching staff, which is going to be kind of piecemeal. So you got that. So that's interesting. And that's just sort of holding the seat for the kid from coming up, the Zach attack. And then number eight, Cody Ashe.
Zach.
A-S-C-H-E-D-H. And then number nine, Avisail Garcia. Who's Cody Ashe?
I don't know.
So it's just a question, and it's interesting. It's like you can't get like an old 40-year-old DH. There's no Jermaine Dye out there that could sort of slide in for the veteran minimum.
Yeah, you don't want that. Maybe they want the young.
I don't know.
You're reading these names, and the only thing I can think of right now, Justin, is the beginning of the Major League movie, where they've got everybody in Cleveland going, "Who are these guys?
Who are these guys?" I'm telling you, man, they're going to win 83. I think they're going to have a good year.
That is because a bold prediction.
I think
they're going to have a good year. 83 wins. That's a good year.
Is that it? Yeah, it's a pretty good.
I mean, it's over 500.
Yeah. All right, so you heard it here. I'm a White Sox. Last year was all Cubs. You guys all cubbed it up up here. Keep cubbing it up. But I have a feeling these young White Sox, they just got to, if they can get a DH, if they can get one guy who's like, oh, Gary Sheffield, that's where he went. You know, some guy like, I don't know, whoever the Gary Sheffield is of 2017, the 41-year-old, you know, oh, interesting. Like an Adam LaRoche. Thanks, Rob. It's time for Studio 435 here on the Download, 720 WGN. This is our weekly segment showcasing some of the best live music Chicago has to offer in our All-State Showcase studio on beautiful Michigan Avenue. And tonight, no different, the band Material Reissue is here. The power pop legacy lives on from the band formerly known as Material Issue. The legendary trio of Jim Ellison, Ted Ansani, and Mike Zelenko enjoyed mainstream success with their 1991 album International Pop Overthrow and tracks like Diane and Valerie Loves Me. They followed up that album with Destination Universe and Freak City Soundtrack. In 1996, tragedy ended Material Issue. Singer and frontman Jim Ellison committed suicide. In 2011, the original members, Ted Ansani and Mike Zelenko, teamed up to bring back the band in honor of the 20th anniversary of International Pop Overthrow. Phil Angotti was tapped to sing. The band Material Reissue played Taste that year. They played Summerfest. They're all over the place. And 5 years later, the band, they're still together. The trio is back on stage at the Metro on March 4th. They're sharing the bill with the Bad Examples and the reunion show for the Lilacs. And they are here tonight, stripped down, ready to play the 1991 single, Renee Remains the Same. Guys, take it away.
But she never got through, and she better get back. And if we look at a yearbook picture, sure we'll see a face that looks a lot like now. She always wanted to be accepted. She was only rejected anyhow. Renee remains the same. Renee, she never changed. She's the same. Well, is she leaving the house tonight? Is she carrying you keys as she waves goodbye? He was the one who was most likely to, but he never got through, and it barely get by. And if we look in a family picture, sure we'll see a face that looks a lot like now. I only wanted to get her attention. I only got rejection. Anyhow, Renee remains the same. Renee, she'll never change. She's the same. A lot like now. I only wanted to get her attention. I only got rejection anyhow. Renee remains the same. Renee, she'll never change. She's the same. She's the same.
How great is that? Yeah! Material reissue in Studio 435 tonight. That's Phil Angotti, Mike Zelenko, Ted Ansani. Material reissue going to be on stage with the Bad Examples and the Lilacs. That's their reunion show. It's just amazing to have you guys in studio. Hearing that music, it sounds wonderful. All right, let's take a break. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, get you guys around the table, and talk a little Material reissue here on the Download Studio 435. Stay with us. Studio 435 here on the Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. The band Material reissue in studio with us tonight. They are around the mics. Ted Ansani, Mike Zelenko, and Phil Angotti here. They are playing on the 4th, March 4th, with the Bad Examples and the Lilacs. That's the reunion show. It's a big show.
For the Lilacs.
Yeah, yeah, right, right.
And I heard at the top before we started playing, was that a Green song I heard? That was Up All Night by Green, who actually I play drums for.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
See, there you go. Beats by Zim, Pete Zimmerman in there. Yeah. So let's talk about this. I mean, this was a project, Ted, that, you know, I mean, this was a 20th anniversary project, Material reissue. I mean, the idea of celebrating that great record.
Yeah.
Talk about it. It's been a couple years since that, but you're continuing to play.
It had been a while since Mike and I had played together. And we realized that the record company was going to go ahead and re-release. They repackaged the International Pop Overthrow with some outtakes, maybe a live track or something.
I think they remastered it, too.
Remastered it and put it out as a 20th anniversary edition. So we, at the time, I don't know if we were talking about playing already or not. International Pop Overthrow Festival was coming through town, which is another festival that has all kinds of pop bands and power pop bands play in different cities throughout the United States. So we were asked to play that, and it just coincided and made a nice package deal for everyone involved.
Yeah, we weren't really asked. I think we just kind of was like, ding, ding, ding. It's 20 years since our album came out. Wouldn't it be cool to play again? And let's grab Phil, old friend of ours from back in the 90s. Phil was in a band called The Idea.
Yeah, of course.
Phil is a great singer, great songwriter as well. And like I said, he was friends of ours from back when, so he was our first choice to do it. And the idea was to play the album from front to back, like, you know, like a lot of groups will do their records that people enjoy from front to back. So we did it in sequence.
Playing that, doing that, and I mean getting back together to play the record front to back like that. What were the emotions that went along with that? I mean, to be 20 years after the fact, Jim's not here. What was it like to sit down and rehearse that, but then also get up on stage and play those songs again to an audience?
Well, you know, I think, you know, when I contacted Ted about it, he was up for it. And we were both excited to the idea of doing it, especially having someone like Phil, you know, who could fill in and sing within Jim's range and all that stuff and play the guitar parts. We wanted to do it as a three-piece because the band was a three-piece, and to recreate the live that dynamic. But other than being excited about it, we were a little, I was at least a little had some reservations about it because I was afraid no one would show up. And I was like, well, if no one shows up, that would really suck. But then it turned out that we just like put it out. You know, we contacted David Bash from International Pop Overthrow Festival, IPO, and he gave us a slot at the Abbey. Yeah. And it like sold out like a month before. And there were people like outside, like we're down here in Michigan. There were people like standing out the window. So it was really successful and fun. And we were very pleased.
Yeah. And the initial rehearsals were slightly intimidating. It's just that we hadn't played these songs
in so
long.
Right.
And I don't think we had played them all together as one unit, especially in order. And playing them all with Phil, too. And then, you know, it was just, you know, dusting off the cobwebs and ironing everything out and making sure we had all the parts covered.
Right.
After a few rehearsals, we were rehearsing at
Avenue N.
At Avenue N, yeah, at his store. So there's plenty of guitars to choose from and amplifiers and stuff to get the sounds that we wanted. But I think after the second and third rehearsal, we all of a sudden started feeling that fire build up. And you said you saw us in the past. So we definitely had a fire on stage. We were very energetic, and we could feel that kindling and coming up, and we just knew we were going to really dominate.
It's amazing because, you know, I mean, it's kind of, you guys, I think about it, I was at Columbia College, so it would have been early 90s, right? And at that time, I mean, it was a very, not unlike what we see with bands today, whether it be Twin Peaks or Chance the Rapper, where you're like, there's a pride that goes along with the fact that Material Issue was from Chicago, that there was this, you know, you've been in Chicago and you're like, and watching you guys not only have success here and, you know, being able to play the big places like a Vic or the Metro, but to then hear your songs being played on the radio and to have, you know, your stuff on MTV. I mean, there was a point where it was like we got to watch you break. When you think back to those days, I mean, I guess it would be right on this record on International Pop Overthrow talk about those days about, you know, being on MTV and being a band from Chicago that was breaking.
Well, I think what made it special for Chicago and for that time was the atmosphere of the music business at the time. I mean, we had like Styx and Cheap Trick and the band Chicago, but they were kind of like their own entities, and they weren't like, you know, but we had come up from like a scene of other bands, you know, like the Smashing Pumpkins and Urge Overkill, Green, who else? Bad Examples, who we're playing with.
Sure. On,
you know,
Shoes
the
were
idea.
From the area.
But there was this, you know, this scene of, in the late 80s, playing small clubs like Lounge Acts and Batteries Not Included and West End and others. Like Metro back then for us was like the big.
Yeah, right.
That was the big gig, you know. Like you had really arrived, you know, like. And, you know, this whole, like, notion of alternative rock music that was, at that time, you know, in the late 80s on MTV, you know, it was, like, all Poison and, like, hair bands and stuff
right,
like that.
Right.
And we couldn't relate to that. So when we started having some success and signed a major label deal, I think we had brought everyone else with us in a way. And I know that it had helped Chicago and other bands, to be exposed.
Well, I mean,
you guys,
it's interesting because Material Issue was ahead of its time in the way that you think of the bands you even mentioned. I mean, you would play with Smashing Pumpkins or maybe a Urge Overkill, and they had success as well, but their successes, the records that made them big and famous came after Material Issue. They came, you know, the mainstream albums of that we know, the Siamese Dreams and the...
Yeah, I mean, sort of, though, because Urge Overkill was, in a way, was a bigger band than Material Issue, being on Touch and Go and being a pretty reputable indie rock band. And I actually have a flyer from a place called Club Stadola, which was on
Belmont
near Cicero, and it was Smashing Pumpkins, Material Issue, and Urge Overkill.
Wow.
And I was in like 89 or 90 or something. It was like 30 people there.
Wow.
But Urge was like, you know, I mean, they were on Touch and Go, and Touch and Go had all these other great bands, like Big Black and, you know, others. Like, I can't think of.
Well,
right
I don't want to.
Like,
I don't want to disparage the, you know.
But I was just going to say, like.
But you
like,
were the first. Like, you like, had the mainstream appeal at that point.
Sure. I mean, well, you know, Gish came out in 91, you know. But we we with that first album, we went straight to the major label thing, and they threw us completely into, like, we were their top priority, and and they really pushed us, and they wanted us to be their band for the 90s, you know. So yeah, that was a, that was an exciting year for us.
When you think back to those days, Ted, when you think about the that moment of being sort of on a mainstream record, major record, you know, company, and you being their priority, I mean, are those good memories for you guys?
Oh, sure.
I mean, are those the memories that you're like, oh, that was Material Issue, or was it the, or did you have the challenges that a lot of bands talk about? They don't like being on those record labels.
No, we had no problem with it. As a matter of fact, you know, getting from city to city, we were in a different city every day, basically, and a different venue every night. We'd hear ourselves on the radio. We'd, you know, pretty much every morning we would be waking up. They'd take us to some couple of radio stations, and we got to promote our show for that evening. So we were definitely getting airplay. We were promoting ourselves. And we just saw it building. And then, you know, we happened to be somewhere, I don't know, Oklahoma, and we get word that MTV's going to start playing our video, you know. And right away we called home and told our friends and our family, you know, hey, we're going to be on TV tonight, you know.
Yeah, we never did anything that was against our what we didn't want to do. And then when you have that kind of support, I mean, for us, it was like, well, we're here to work.
Yeah.
We're willing to work. We're willing to go on tour, to go to the radio stations and all that stuff. And we had like full days of, like, we would pull into a town and get picked up by a local rep from the radio station and or from the record company. So it was great, you know, and it was, they didn't ask us to do anything or change our music in any way or say anything or do anything that we didn't want to do. So to have that support is awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, we heard a lot about our Chicago style work ethic. They were very impressed with that. We never whined about getting up at 8 a.m. to get to some radio station, or, you know, whatever. We were more than happy to work and promote. And that's, maybe it was because we were so young at the time. Mm-hmm. We really didn't know any better.
We were on the road a lot.
We liked it, though. I mean, you know, yeah. It was fun living on a bus, Yellow Submarine or whatever it was.
Ted Anzani, Mike Zelenko, and Phil Angotti are in studio. They are Material Reissue. They're playing at the Metro coming up here on March 4th. All right, so let's get you guys back behind the microphones. What are we going to hear here?
We're going to do Diane from International Pop Overthrow.
Diane, come on. Doesn't get any better than that, right? Diane, so great, from International Pop Overthrow. Like I said, Ted Anzani, Mike Zelenko, and Phil Angotti. We got to bring Phil in the conversation after. We'll talk some more after the news. We'll get a song here, and then we'll get to the news. Again, they're playing at Metro on March 4th, sharing the bill with the Bad Examples and the Lilacs. It's a Lilacs reunion show, which is exciting. But right now we are going to hear some music from International Pop Overthrow. This is the track Diane. Come on, who doesn't remember Diane? All right, hold on 1 second. Bob is getting back, and we are ready for Diane Material Reissue here in Studio 435. Take it away, guys.
Diane.
else in the world. Dying, pretending to be some kind of calendar girl. Well, I'll pull you out and I'll pin you down. Dying.
Material reissue in studio. That's the track Diane from International Pop Overthrow. Material reissue playing on March 4th, sharing the bill with the Bad Examples and the Lilacs. They are in studio tonight, the Allstate Showcase Studio here in Michigan Avenue. Ted Ansani, Mike Zelenko, and Phil Angotti here in studio. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the news. And then we'll talk some more about material reissue. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman at Studio 435. Every Monday night, we bring you the best Chicago's got to offer in terms of live music, and tonight's no different. Material reissue in studio. The power pop legacy lives on from the band Material Issue. In studio, Ted Ansani, Mike Zelenko, and Phil Angotti. They are playing March 4th, sharing the bill with the Bad Examples and the Lilacs. What a lineup. Come on. I mean, that's a great 90s lineup. You're going to go see it at Metro on the 4th.
We're not dead yet.
No. Right. Well, I mean, you know, the Phil, it's amazing to me. I mean, we didn't bring you into the conversation. The, you know, when approached to do this work, and you guys have known each other for years, but to do this work, to essentially be Jim Ellison, to this idea of you know, such a distinct voice, is that a challenge to do that?
You know, it's a challenge to make it sound as authentic as possible, but honestly, it's very easy for me because we have similar voice timbre. We both grew up listening to the same music, obviously.
Yeah.
We have the same influences. We have the same upper register, so it's real natural. So I'm not so much imitating Jim, although I try to grab some nuances of, you know, we actually imitate Jim's talking voice more than we do his singing voice. These guys do it great. But, you know, there's like little things, you know, he's got a little bit of a sneer to his voice sometimes, like when he's singing, you know, like going through your purse, he's got a great, you know, and you light it too, and yeah, you know, and some of that attitude, I do try to put some of that in, but I'm mm-hmm. still mainly just trying to sing the song as good as possible. But I put a little of that in there without making it sound like I'm totally imitating.
Right,
so
right.
It's nice that it works. And it's just a lot of fun because I really am a big fan of the music. I love the song.
It's amazing.
Yeah, and we weren't interested in being like, you know, we would never ask Phil to, like, you know, sound more like someone else or sound more like Jim, you know. And to me, it that would be like being in a cover band that you were actually in.
Yeah, right, right.
So we just see it as like, and that's why we kept it as Material Reissue, because Material Issue never officially broke up. You know, I mean, Jim passed away, and it was just that Ted and I decided to not go on as Material Issue without him. So I guess this is the next best thing. So we don't want to, like, you know, that was then and this is now, and we're doing the songs from then.
You know, I guess take us back to that decision. You know, for you guys, Jim passes away, you decide no more Material Issue. I mean, you could have done the same concept, brought Phil in or brought other singers in and tried to recreate the magic that you had from the records before. I mean, it was 1996. What was really at the core of you guys calling it quits or not carrying on with Material Issue?
I think we were ready for a break, definitely, and we really hadn't taken much of a break. I had two kids by that time, here in Chicago, And so I was ready to just kind of take a step back from the whole industry for however long. I hadn't really thought it out. And I know after Jim died, I was kind of thinking, like, what are we going to do now? How do we carry on? And it was, at the time, for me, it was a good decision personally to just stop playing and concentrate on my family.
Yeah.
But then it started kind of bubbling back up. And
yeah, we were on the road for basically, I mean, well, we, you know, we worked, it wasn't like International Pop Overthrow was like, that was our, we were a band for three years before that, and we put out our own records, and we were touring in my van for like 3 years before we got our deal. So, and that just never stopped from the, you know, from struggling in the van and having no money, and then getting a deal and getting a little more comfortable, and then really, really working. Where, and we were one of those bands, it wasn't so much like, you know, it was more like how much are you off the road than you're on the road. We were on the road so much. You know, we're, on, mm-hmm. we're doing over 200 dates
that,
a year.
That Chicago work ethic.
Yeah.
So that, and then when that all came, you know, and then, of course, you have to deal with, you know, with losing the leader of the band and main creative element of the band as far as songs went. So it was just like, what do we do now? And then, honestly, I don't think we ever really thought about doing, you know, there were people that approached us too. It was like, oh, well, you should check out this guy should be there. And someone mentioned some other people and it's like, no, you know, it just didn't, it was almost like, you know, like Nirvana going on without Kurt Cobain. It just didn't make sense to us.
Let me ask you guys, I mean, it's been 20 plus years now, you know, 1996 and Jim took his life. You know, I think back to that time, and it was such a public thing, right? I mean, it was a public thing. There were news reports and MTV and all this kind of stuff about that story and Jim. You know, for you guys, and not just as bandmates, but as Phil, the just the music community that was around it. I mean, it was a pretty emotional time. Talk about that. I mean, reflecting on that from 20 years ago, the death of Jim Ellison.
It was horrible because not only are you losing a good friend, you know, you're losing a band member, you're losing someone you've been working with very, very closely for 10 years, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and we started together as kids, you know, and Jim was a couple years older than us, then Ted and I were about the same age. Jim was about 4 years older than us, and, you know, I always looked up to him and stuff, and I... So, yeah, for me, it was like, I just remember not wanting to, like, play at all, not wanting to, like, do any kind of music stuff. The last person, kind of person I wanted to talk to was some kind of record company person, kind of, like, giving me some sort of, like, pitch as to, like, what, you know, what you do next. And, like, frankly, like, our band at that point, we had some good success, put out three records on Mercury Polygram, but... we were having a bit of a hard time, you know, staying in and staying relevant with all these other great bands that were coming out. So, it never crossed my mind to sort of pick up on it right after that or soon after that.
Ted, what were some of the emotions that, you know, I mean, obviously losing a friend and a bandmate, but the concept that it was such a public story too. I mean,
it was total shock for us, I think, personally and individually, but people who knew Jim really, I think, could connect with his personality for the most part. He was definitely very friendly to everyone he met. He could carry on a conversation with anybody sitting at a bar. You know, we'd do a sound check and then kind of separate from the stage and go our own ways. And somebody would just walk right up to Jim and he'd be more than happy to strike up a conversation and buy you a drink and hang out and say, hey, coming to see us tonight or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, on many different levels here in Chicago, people that knew him, the people that we had met working with record companies, radio stations, record stores, outlets, people, so many people had the chance to meet him and get to know him that I think that's kind of why it was so widespread. A lot of people knew him. He was definitely a very powerful personality.
Yeah, definitely.
Powerful for sure. He was a bit abrasive too. And I think in Chicago, there were certain people like, you know, I'll just say, like, at the time, the Wicker Park type people, before Wicker Park is what it is today, I think that they were a bit rubbed off by him a bit because Jim was Jim was an extremely intelligent guy, but he didn't have like a refinement to him, you know. And there were, for me, I remember reading, I think, I can't remember who wrote it, but it was in the Reader, and it was a real negative, backhanded kind of thing, and kind of like, you know, and, you know, as being a guy that everyone in town knew, especially in the music community, I was just like really hurt by it and angry reading that. And I just wanted to like drive over to
the Reader,
that publication, the
well,
Reader.
And, you know, and it's in, that's a,
so it was really yeah. that like I couldn't take it. I didn't want, I like shut, I didn't, I couldn't read that anymore.
Wasn't there, I mean, you go back to the 90s and there was this sort of indie pop kind of beginning to the 90s, and it transitioned into a harder Pearl Jam, alt rock. It kind of moved from Chicago to Seattle. And you're right. I mean, and part of what I remember about you guys and the, you know, the death of Jim was, you know, the sort of snark that also came about, meaning that, you know, you'd have people that would say, eh, I didn't really like their music. You know, or something like that, to that effect, based on, you know, someone passing. Mm. And I always, I think, I was just thinking about when you guys were talking, I'm like, man, I'm so glad Facebook wasn't around. Mm. You know, but to take away the legacy and what Material Issue meant to Chicago and to pave the way for the bands that came after, I mean, is a part that when you think back to those backhanded Reader stories or the way that Jim Ellison just sort of was because of his...
And there wasn't
bombastic kind of personality taken the wrong way.
There wasn't a lot of that, but even the small amount of it for me personally, you know, was hard. But I think definitely more a majority of people from who remember that time back then, who were around back then, give him the credit he deserves.
Yeah, Phil. I mean, as someone on the outside looking in,
yeah, that's a good question. Like, I met Jim at a guitar show because we're both guitar fans. We like collecting vintage guitars. That's how I kind of first met him. I got to know him a little bit better, and sadly, right before he died, I saw him a couple times. I was playing a show with Paul Collins and the Beat, and Jim was at the Beat Kitchen. He comes over. Hey, Phil, where's Paul? Could you bring him over? I'd like to say hi to him. And, you know, so I bring Paul over. This is Jim from Material Issue. And Jim actually came to see me play at a show, Thurston's, I think it was called. And Jim was, again, we were both power pop fans and songwriters that liked a lot of the same music. In fact, Jim booked me at Battery Not Included back when he was booking bands. Mm-hmm. So he did like my band. So we knew each other that way. You know, speaking from, like, a peer, you know, like, mm-hmm. I was very happy and proud of these guys. And I mean, there wasn't like jealousy. I was like, wow, a pop band doing music that I like and do myself is getting attention. I thought it was great. I think a lot of people did. There's always going to be jealousies.
Well,
and factions
and also it was more, I want to say jealousies. I would say it's a genre change.
Like
you said, like the guys in Wicker Park are more interested in a different kind of music than
exactly.
Power pop.
Well, the thing is, we also were not shy about, saying that we wanted to be on a major label, making, as we call them, big league records. You know, we wanted to sell records. We didn't want to like pretend that like, oh, you like us, but you're not the kind of person that we want you to like us. You know, we just never played right. that game. And, so I think there were some people, especially back then, the climate of back then. Today, that like every young band wants to have work that's willing to work, that's good, that's talented. They want to work and be as successful as they want to be. But back then, if you were to like say it, you know, it was almost like, well, that's not cool. Yeah. That's not cool. You want to sell records? It's like, well, you're going to pay my rent. You're going to pay my electric bill and stuff.
Right. In studio with me, Ted Ansani, Mike Zelenko, and Phil Angotti. We're talking to Material Reissue. Let's take a break, come back. We'll get your last song tonight here in Studio 435. They're playing at Metro on March 4th, sharing the bill with the Bad Examples and the Lilacs. They're our guests tonight at Studio 435. We'll take a break. Stay with us. It's 720 WGN, The Download. I'm Justin Kaufman. Studio 435 with Material Reissue live. Ted Ansani, Mike Zelenko, and Phil Angotti are here. They are playing at Metro on March 4th. They're sharing the bill with Bad Examples and the Lilacs. It's a Lilacs reunion show.
It's been a pleasure to have these guys in studio tonight talking about the glory days, talking about music, talking about material issue, material reissue. Here they are with the track live in studio, The Next Big Thing.
I met her at a bar where I often sit down and have myself a drink. She played my favorite song before I had time to think. Bought her round and she pounded it down, let out a laugh like a freight train. We exchanged small talk, doesn't it feel like rain? She said, you and I are two of a kind, not afraid to dream. We could have been the next big thing. She told me her roommate was gone for the weekend, borrowed a car and took off with a boyfriend. They'd be marrying soon. Was it December or June? She was an artist with a two-bedroom apartment. Her dad kept it going on a weekly allowance. She'd be graduating soon. Was it December or June? And she said, you and I are two of a kind, not afraid to dream. We could have been the next big. So I bought her one more and she stared at the door, watching the parade moving out and in. She made fun of their clothes, she said that I could never be one of those. So I thought to myself, you're just like everybody else, standing at the station but missing the train. I turned to gauge her expression, she walked back home in the rain. And she said, you and I, two of a kind, not afraid to dream. We could have been the next big thing. The next big thing. The next big thing. The next big thing.
Material reissue in studio, Ted Ansani, Mike Zelenko, and Phil Angotti. They are playing at the Metro on March 4th with the Bad Examples and the Lilacs. Material reissue in studio. It's a pleasure, guys. I mean, it really is to have you guys in studio to hear your music. If you want to hear Valerie Loves Me, you got to go to the show, right?
Right. Yeah. And we just got to mention, we're going to have a couple of guitar players playing with us that night. We've got Jay O'Rourke from the Insiders playing with us also that night, and Lou Hollis. Sweet Lou Hollis from The Difference and the Penthouse Suites.
How fun is it for you guys to be able to get back on stage, to do this, to promote the shows, to feel like, you know, it's the gang's back together?
Yeah. I'd be at home playing with my fire stick right now. That's great. Thanks for having us. And also, with those additional musicians, some of the songs are a little more fuller sounding, so... Back in the day, it was just the three of us.
Right.
But so now we got second guitar parts and some keyboard parts and stuff that were on the recordings. And we've gotten feedback from old fans saying that it's the best we've ever sounded.
All right.
Yeah.
All right.
Hope to see you all there.
There you go. There it's Metro, March 4th, The Bad Examples and the Lilacs. Again, Ted Ansani, Mike Zelenko, and Phil Angotti. Material reissue. Thanks, guys. Thanks
for being
here.
Thank you, Justin. Thank you.
Thanks to Bob Ferguson. That was great, man. Material reissue in studio. Man, I didn't even get a chance to ask them too much about the weird Q101 show I went to. That was in the morning. Whether or not it was their tour bus that used to park. I was asking them in the break because I lived in Roscoe Village when I first came to Chicago, and they lived in Roscoe Village. So that was like the big thing. Oh, you live where Material Issue lives. And then once in a while, you would get a huge tour bus that would be like on parked on Roscoe. And instead of being mad, we'd be like, all right, all right. Patty Vasquez up next. Patty, how are you?
I'm well. Happy Monday.
How was the weekend?
It was great. I met Ozzie Smith.
What?
I did a fundraiser in St. Louis. And if there's going to be a Cardinal player that you're going to meet.
Yeah, right. That's the one.
I didn't
That's the one.
Yeah, that's the only one,
that's
really.
That's the only one.
I didn't know that I was going to start crying when I met him. Because I grew up as a kid, I lived and died by baseball, right? So it was a fun rivalry. But who couldn't fall in love with the zest he had? Those backflips? I told him.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I said, you know, I did gymnastics because my dream was to be able to do a backflip like Ozzie Smith. And he goes, were you a gymnast? And I go, no, I was a baseball player.
That's so great.
Wonderful.
How great is that? Yeah, so that's great. Cool. That's a good weekend thing to do. Hang out with Ozzie Smith.
Yeah. How was your weekend?
It was good. We walked around the block. It was really nice out.
It was so pretty out. I didn't get to go outside because I was getting ready for that show. So, and it was cooler in St. Louis.
I would much rather hang out with Ozzie Smith.
It was crazy.
What's on the show tonight?
We have Paul Farvars coming in. We'll talk about some local things going on, and then we've got a band coming in. I don't remember I have a rundown right in front of me. We have
Heidemann's good with the rundowns.
Kazuki Ramen and Izaki in Wicker Park, and we've got Matt Fetterman and Janine Tanner are coming in studio.
Okay, great.
Let's do some music.
There you go. All right. Well, have a great show tonight.
Have a good night.